Good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, September 5th, 2016. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern to midnight. If you're listening live over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-562-3140. Our participant code is 385698. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support National Liberty Alliance's effort to save America. And also please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side. And as for donations, again, we really appreciate anyone who can give us a donation of $5 a month or more. We do have some people who do give us more, 10, 20 bucks, and so on. But most people do just give five. If everyone of all of our members were to give, we'd be just swimming in money, literally, because we have thousands of members, but we don't get donations from everyone. But if you believe in us, come on, let's do something about it. We are having a lot of problems in the past 3-4 months paying bills. This month is becoming a really bad month for paying bills. We need money. And if you want to continue to see us and work with us, you're going to have to donate to keep us going here. So please consider a donation. Okay, let's go to tonight's scripture. Tonight's scripture is going to be reading at Luke chapter 6. We're going to be reading verses 27 through 36, and I might read a few verses after that. But we'll see how that goes at the moment. But Luke 6, verses 27 through 36, love of enemy. Here's the Lord speaking. But I say unto you, which hear, love your enemy. Do good to them which hate you. Bless them that curse you. Pray for them which despitefully use you. And unto him that smiteth thee on the one cheek, offer also the other. And him that taketh away thy cloak, forbid not to take thy coat also. Give to every man that asketh of thee, and of him that taketh away thy goods, ask them not again. And as ye would that men should do to you, do ye also to them likewise. For if ye love them which love you, what thank have ye, for sinners also love those that love them? And if ye do good to them which do good to you, what thank have ye, for sinners also do even the same? And if ye lend to them of whom ye hope to receive, what thank have ye, for sinners also lend to sinners, to receive as much again? But love ye your neighbors, do good, and lend, hoping for nothing again, and your reward shall be great, and ye shall be the children of the highest, for he is kind unto the unthankful and to the evil. Be ye therefore merciful, as your Father also is merciful. Judge not, and ye shall not be judged. Condemn not, and ye shall not be condemned. Forgive, and ye shall be forgiven. Give, and it shall be given unto you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and runneth over, shall men give unto your bosom. For with the same measure that ye meet withal, it shall be measured to you again. Okay, that was Luke chapter 6, verses 27, and I did read through to 38. Okay, let's see, tonight, what are we going to talk about? Let's see what we've got going here. First of all, I want to make an announcement concerning Skype. We've been having a lot of problems communicating with Skype. They are advancing and changing things in ways that are really giving us a lot of problems. I know personally I've been having a lot of problems talking to certain individuals that we talk all the time, and vice versa. We have a lot of problems trying to take on 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 callers at a time as we're talking. You know, we have people who call in, and as we're talking, we add them to our conversations so that we can, talk with as many people as possible and give as much information out as people are requesting or looking for, and hopefully not get a just a ringing phone. We do use Skype for phones also, so if people call me on the phone and want to talk to me, you know, if I can't pull them into a Skype call and I'm on a call, then I lose that call. But anyway, others are having the same problems. We also have problems recording calls. It's extremely important for us to record calls because sometimes some of our calls have a lot of good information, and we want to maybe make notes of those things or whatever. So we record all our calls and usually delete them after a month or two. They're just, you know, most calls or most information is just deleted. But again, it is good to have when you have a really good phone call and you got a lot of new information, and especially if it's an overwhelming overspill of information and it's new information, you know, remembering this stuff is difficult, but we can go back and then maybe do a transcript of the information and do better in our understanding of the things we need to understand. So anyway, with all these problems, we started looking for another service to use because communications is a very important tool with what we're doing. The national leadership is communicating pretty much all the time. There's always communications going on, whether it is actually on phone calls, usually through Skype calls, you know, email information, different meetings, and so on. There's just a lot of activity going on often throughout the day through leadership. And so we need something that's really going to be reliable, and we need something that works well. Skype had been that thing, but it's now become a problem. We came to a solution, and the solution is to step back a few months in Skype. This idea was brought to us by Pamela, because Pamela told us, which is the recording program that we do use, told us, I guess, that Skype had made some changes, and Pamela had not yet caught up to them yet. But there are other problems. So I think we're going to solve a lot of these problems just by going to the older Skype. We will put a page up. We'll announce where that page is next week for anyone to download that Skype, the older Skype. And if you do that for communication purposes with us, then you'll want to shut off any automatic updates. And also with the Pamela, we've also got the latest Pamela, so that as things escalate, you can also get the older Skype. And again, it's Pamela, and you're going to want to also check off for no upgrades. The problem is if you start to update, sometimes you can't communicate with older Skype, or the Skype or the Pamela may not work. So if Pamela advances itself and we're on older Skype, the new Pamela may not work with the older Skype. So we're just going to maintain an older Skype and live with that as long as possible until something else better comes along, or maybe this will suffice. Maybe we'll be able to get away with this for a long time. I know I had a very, very old software that had a lot of problems working with other platforms. And by the time it got to XP, it just wasn't working anymore. But XP had the ability of using an older platform. Anything after XP, my software that I have doesn't work. And the software that I'm talking about is software that cannot be replaced by any other software. Because I have I have Windows 7 with... I forget what they call that, but I can open up an XP inside of it, okay? And so I'm able to use that software. But once that disappears, I'm not going to be able to use that software anymore. And the same thing may happen here with Skype. At some point, we're going to have to look for something else maybe, but we'll see how things go. So again, anybody that is using Skype, particularly communicating with us, we're going to post some more information on that. We'll send out an email on it. We'll also post where you can download the older Skypes, and you're going to want to probably connect with the older stuff in order to communicate with National Liberty Alliance's leadership. Phone calls should still be able to come in no matter what Skype you're using anyway, so that'll work. Okay, let's move on from there. Everybody knows we're pushing on the ham radios and the radio plan. We do finally have a plan. We do finally have located a place where we'll be purchasing all of the radios for reselling. We've got a hold of a lot of different what we feel is necessary, not a lot, but certain things that we feel is necessary as far as that people should have as far as the accessories. So we'll be selling some accessories. We'll be selling some CB radios, two different levels of them, and we'll be selling a whole bunch of other products. We finally got the bank account straightened out. We are able now. It's not up yet, but hopefully in the next 24 hours or sometime this week, I'm going to be working on it day and night after tonight's program until we get this up and running. The new store, the NLA store, which you'll find on the top right-hand side, which we're going to update and get this thing working, and people will be able to go up there and purchase. And also people will be able to donate to it without going through PayPal anymore. Whoever's donating through PayPal, that can continue. Anything new will be coming through a new process and going into National Liberty Alliance's bank account direct without going through PayPal. And that's a huge thing for us. There are a lot of people that say that they don't want to use PayPal, and to people who say that they would be given if they could use a credit card and go online. So we're going to have that. Hopefully that's going to help us a little more with being able to pay the bills. More people will hopefully be giving to us, so we'll be thankful for that. Committees of Safeties, again, we're meeting every Thursday. There's a lot of things going on, so we had a pretty good conversation last Thursday. I don't know if I uploaded last Thursday. Jen, did you upload last Thursday? Did I upload it? Do you know? I don't know if we did. It was a pretty good meeting. Yeah. We might want to if we didn't. Did you upload it?
Yes. Yes, I put it up there.
Okay. And it's showing up on the COS page, right? Okay. All right. All right. So that is up there for anybody who wasn't at that meeting. It's a little more than an hour. We try to keep that down on an hour, so maybe hour and 10 minutes. I don't know. But it was a good meeting, a lot of good information. We did get off point, but that's where we did get a lot of information, what's going on in the Robinson case up there in Montana, and also what's going on in Oregon, and a lot of different things that people might be interested in hearing and understanding and knowing what's going on. Okay, so anyway, that's there. I also want to remind everyone that time is short and that we need money, okay? We really want to push these radios. It is extremely important that we the people are able to communicate with we the people during the times of emergencies. And it won't be the normal meetings, of course, but we'll be online through the emergency process that we're setting up, we the people, through what we have been bringing together under, you know, National Liberty Alliance's banner, so to speak, but really working with the grand jury and working with the COSs to connect every potential county that can set up to get a communications going during the times of emergencies. There'll be a time set up on what times we'll be connecting, and we'll be transmitting information across the nation that's important for people to know with what's going on at the time. Therefore, if there is skirmishes going on or something of that nature, people need to know about it. If things are peaceful in another area, people need to know about it. People need to know what's going on. Nothing worse than being having no communications and being totally in the dark, especially under emergency situations. Certainly, we're not going to be able to believe anything that's going to be transmitted over radios and TV. We, the people, need to have our own system set up. So we really want to push this far and wide, the setup that we've got going. And we need to get this going word of mouth everywhere and anywhere. Even if people are not involved directly with us with the National Liberty Alliance, no matter what it is that they think, you know, for whatever purposes, because, of course, the lie is out there. Deception is out there. The point is, though, we've got to get the message out that we, the people, need to communicate. Everyone should tap in and prepare for potential emergency communications during hard times. So we'll be pushing this program really hard starting next week, and we should have all of the necessary information, offering the programming and our plan completely, and different protocols that people might want to follow through with, and different information that people will want to collect. At least one source within each county should collect a lot of intellectual or educational material concerning freedom, concerning liberty, concerning what it is that we're doing here at National Liberty Alliance. And getting back to needing money, I'll say it again, we need money. I hate to beg, I hate to ask, but I have to. If the bills are being paid, I wouldn't be asking. We've got a long time in the past where we didn't ask for money much because money was coming through. But we bills have raised, gotten high, and if we can't keep up with the bills, we're going to little by little fall apart here, because it's not free, regardless of what people might think. I mean, I get people tell me, I get websites at $10 a month or something, and you know, you should go here. But look, I've been there. I know all about that. I know how that works. It doesn't work with what we're doing. Trust me. We have broadband. And unlimited web space is not unlimited web space. That's all a lie anyway. You're really sharing a particular server with maybe 20 or 40 or 60 or even 100 people. Okay, and when you start to use a little too much of that space, you get a little email, and they'll even shut you down for a while, and you have to start pulling this stuff off. And I'm talking about these programs that claim unlimited. It's just a lie. But anyway, with what we're doing, we deal with broadband, we deal with storage space. We're very heavy site. We've got a lot of video and audio, heavy. We got a lot of written materials, PDFs, and we take up a lot of space. It costs us money. And there are many other bills. We have 8 fax lines that go out. We're going to be really pushing those in the next week or so. We're going to really push hard again on that. But we do have 8 fax lines that broadcast out, could broadcast out full-time. It hasn't been lately, but we're going to be doing that again. We have a lot of things, and we got a very, very expensive and technical system set up here to really deal with all this stuff, and numerous computers that work this system out and monitors and so on. So anyway, let's keep us going. Okay, let's see what we're going to cover. I think I'm just going to cover one thing. It's a 6-pager that I'm going to read tonight. It's a memorandum. You can find a copy of this memorandum on our website. If you go up to our website, nationallibertyalliance.org, go to Grand Jury, highlight Grand Jury, come down to Memorandums of Law. And the one we're going to look at tonight is called Article 3 Courts. Now, this is the first time I'm articulating it, that, in other words, I'm speaking it out loud. And often when, the real check on a piece of paper or a piece of work when you're working on it is really to read it out loud. So this is the first time I'm going to be doing that. So we may have some errors, and by reading it out loud, we'll find these errors and correct them and then update the paper. Sometimes we are redundant with certain, quotes that we put in here, and we pick them up when we, at least I do, when I read it out loud. So this is our first reading of this, and again, it's called Memorandum of Law in Support of Article 3 Courts. Okay? It's titled on the page, Memorandum, Article 3 Courts. But on the paper itself, it says Memorandum of Law in Support of Article 3 Courts. It's extremely important to understand how our system was set up according to our Constitution. And there is no leeway in between. They cannot open any court other than the courts that we have been given them the authority to open under the Constitution. And this is what this covers. And the fact that this particular memorandum shows the fact that all the federal courts are operating under jurisdictions unknown. I know people will call them operating under the law of the sea. And I'm sure they mix a lot of that stuff into that. But actually, they've got a lot of legislation fiction created by the Bar Association. The Bar Association has gone to war a long time ago against we the people, against our Constitution, and therefore against we the people. And they have taught their students, and their judges are their students, and a lot of them believe the same thing. The common law has been done away with; it's been abrogated. And don't bother using the Constitution. We could statutes that work all this out. Use the statutes; it's much easier, it's much clearer, and it gets to the point, and that's that. They've really taken us far, far away from where our founding fathers had originally brought us. So this paper, I think, pretty much clears it up. I hope it does. For me, it does. And maybe after we read it, maybe we'll add some more, or maybe we'll be right on point and we don't have to add anymore. But we'll start reading this. Like I said, it's 6 pages. It's not too much. There's quite a bit of, in some of these pages, there's quite a bit of footnotes, so it's not really 6 pages. Of course, there's a heading and a footer, and that takes some spaces also, so it's not that long a read. Okay. All right. Let's see. It starts off, Memorandum of Law in Support of Article 3 Courts. Now, we have not filed this anywhere yet, but we are writing memorandums to put them up in support of papers we're getting ready to file. And we're putting them up here for educational purposes. People can take and download these things and rewrite them for their own cases. And they could do what they please with it, you know. But you've got to be careful not to get lost into things that really get you into the fiction and off base, and you find yourself in another jurisdiction. Very easy to get lost in jurisdictions unknown when you walk into these courts. And I can't even say especially the federal courts. It doesn't matter, federal, state. It doesn't matter what court you run into. They don't even know what jurisdiction they're in because they can't tell you. They don't know. They don't know what it means to be a criminal court. If they say it's a criminal court, well, then that's statutory, and they have no power to fine or incarcerate. That may sound strange to people, but that's a fact. They do fine, and they do incarcerate anyway, which makes their crime even greater, and we need to make these people understand that. And at some point in time, God, Lord willing, we will. But anyway, Memorandum of Law, Support of Article 3 Courts. First title is called Covenant. It is by the following words in our founding documents upon which all law rests, whereby we the people called upon God and made a covenant. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal stations to which laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the cause which impels them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new governments, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. And that, of course, is the Declaration of Independence. God's covenant, founded upon the law of the land, is eternal. It and cannot be broken on behalf of another. This law is called common law because it is common unto all men, or natural law because it is innate, written in the hearts of men. Thereby, the authority vested in we the people, instituted by decree, in our Constitution, created a republican form of government to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Whereas we read, we the people, through this Constitution, empowered, elected, and appointed servants to guard the same. The Constitution cannot be altered or abolished by the legislative servants who took an oath to protect it. Any judge who does not comply with his oath or to the Constitution for the United States wars against that Constitution and engages in acts in violations of the supreme law of the land. The judge is engaged in acts of treason. And that was under Cooper versus Aaron. Creation of Article 3 Courts. It is in Article 3, Section 1, where authority is given to create courts. We the people vested power in only one Supreme Court and empowered Congress to ordain and establish inferior courts, whereas judges hold office only so long as they are in good behavior. Article 3, Section 1, the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. The judges both of the Supreme and inferior courts shall hold their office during good behavior. You know, and we do define it here, so let me go on. Good behavior is defined in Article 6 as being obedient to the law of the land, which is obedience to the common law. Therefore, any judge not in good behavior would be in bad behavior and forfeit their office. Article 6, Clause 2. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuant thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges in every state shall be bound. Shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or the laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding. Legislative authority to create Article III courts. Congress has been given power to create only Article III courts of record and equity, ruled by American jurisprudence. So Article III courts of record and equity, which is ruled by American jurisprudence. They don't even get a chance to really, really judge. They have to respond according to American jurisprudence, and jurisprudence is a science. But anyway, they have been not given the power to create statutory courts, also known as nisi prius courts. We find this. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 9. The Congress shall have the power to constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court, as referred to on Article 3, Section 1. 28 U.S.C. Subsection 132, creation and composition of district courts. There shall be in each judicial district the district court, which shall be a court of record, known as the United States District Court for the district. Now, I'd like to stop here for a second, because a lot of people have told me that even I've got the wrong name and going into the wrong court, and nothing could be further from the truth, okay? But these people in these courts are acting under the color of law. They've hijacked these courts to jurisdictions unknown. And, you know, I'm not going to say what jurisdiction, and a lot of people think that they know what jurisdiction, but they don't know, because it's really just a throw together of whatever they want at the time to do. They make it up as they go. They break even their own rules. It's jurisdictions unknown. And it clearly is not Article III courts. But here, quite clearly, is where Congress wrote it up in 28 U.S.C. subsection 132, where it talks about the creation of the courts, which we gave them the authority to do so under Article III. Okay, and they call it this. They call it United States District Courts for the District. And every court we go into on the federal level is called, for instance, for the one out in Oregon, we're in the United States District Court for the District of Oregon. We're here in New York. We're in the Southern District. We're probably going into Northern District and some other places. But here in New York, because we have more than one in the state, it's called United States District Court for the Southern District of New York. Okay? These are properly named courts. Those are the proper names. And this is the name that's given in 28 U.S.C. subsection 132. And the authority for them to write this legislation was given to them in the Constitution under Article 3. We've given them the power and the authority. And the Congress very specifically, you know, in Article 3 is where we described it, but it was in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 9, is where we really gave them the Congress directly the power to do so, where, again, I'll read this. We just read it, but I'll read it again. The Congress shall have the power to constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court. And that brings them right back to Article 3. They can't go outside that box. We put them inside of a box. We, the people, can go outside the box. We can think outside the box. We can act outside the box. We can do outside the box, because we, the people, are where law comes from. Court is where law comes from. Law is whatever we say it is. That's what the law is. And, of course, we have to be under the king of the court and being judging righteously, bringing his law, not ours particularly that we make up like these clowns do. But anyway, We are called this very court that is spoken of in 28 U.S.C. 132. So let me read this now. Creation and composition of district courts. There shall be in each judicial district a district court, which shall be a court of record. You can't argue with that one right there. They're calling these courts of record. The legislators understood it was a court of record. They declared them as courts of record, and that's what they are. And a court of a record is a court that proceeds according to the common law with a jury. Every criminal case must have a jury. You can have the equity courts if it's more than $20 that's involved in the case, you know, a case between two individuals. And if it's over $20 that's a value involved in the case, either one of them can require a trial by jury, bring them right into a court of record. The decision of a court of record is final. United States Supreme Court cannot overturn the decision of a court of record because we are the people who bring, we are those who create law. Our word is final. And that jury has the power to nullify any law that's brought up into that court and say, we don't like that law, or it doesn't work in this case, and we're not going to apply it. And we know what's right and coming from the heart because God wrote it into our hearts. This is the law we're going to apply, and this is what we're going to enforce, and this is what we say, and this is what needs to happen. And the United States Supreme Court cannot say diddly about that. The prosecutor or the judge cannot say diddly about that. So we have to understand that. We have to come speaking with power and authority. Hey, Jan, are you out there?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. I just want to make sure I'm still here because hearing strange noise on my computer. If I disappear or something, you know,
I'll let you know.
You on Skype or something. Okay. So they can't say diddly. They can't say nothing. They can't do nothing. Power is knowledge. Knowledge is power. Well, power is knowledge. Either way, we the people need to know. Once we know and we apply it and we come in one accord with great force, they're over. Their game is done. So law comes ultimately from the people. And righteous law under the covenant with God comes ultimately from God. It's the law written in the hearts of men. And there is a lot of legislative law that we've given authority to for them to write that is good law, and we will use it. And we will rule null and void anything that is repugnant to the law of the heart, to the law of the case in that case. You know, sometimes it could be good law in one case, but just doesn't work in another. You know, that is really the genius of common law courts. There is no real formula. It's all worked out through somewhat with logic, principles, out of justice and mercy in the mind and the hearts, and you know, ultimately what comes out of the heart. That's where it comes. That's where the law comes from. Okay. Let me pick back up. There shall be in each judicial district a district court, which shall be a court of record known as the United States District Court for the District. Each district shall consist of the district judge or judges for the district in regular active service. Justices or judges designated or assigned shall be competent to sit as judges of the court. Except as otherwise, and by the way, they think anything that's competent, generally speaking, is law, is bar lawyers, generally. Okay, that's what they think is competent. But anyway, the sitters, judges of the court. Except as otherwise provided by law or rule or order of the court. The judicial power of the district court with respect to any action, suit, or proceeding may be exercised by a single judge who may preside alone and hold a regular or special session of court at the same time other sessions are held by other judges. But let me tell you something, even though a judge is holding it, if they're in a court of record and a jury that is there, they are the tribunal, and that judge has to respect and realize that. He is really the traffic cop. Of course, if it turns out to be a court of equity, which they have the power and the authority to do by the will of the people through the Constitution, and written up through legislation, but they have to follow the American jurisprudence, which is a science. And maybe we talk about this in here. If not, we'll talk about it somewhere else. Authority to appoint judges and court officers. Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2. The president shall have power to nominate, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint judges of the Supreme Court and all other officers of the United States whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for, and which shall be established by law. But the Congress may by law vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper in the president alone in the courts of law. A court of law is one that proceeds according to the common law. Again, we need to understand the meaning of words. They call statutes law. No, statutes are statutes. They're not law. They're statutes. We can chuck them out anytime we want inside of a court as a tribunal. We need to understand that. Generally, it is law, but it still needs to be called a statute. It needs to be realized. Okay, Article 3, Courts. Our Constitution provides for courts of equity and courts of law. The former is a court not of record, that is presided over by a judge whose decision can be appealed. The latter is a court of record, presided over by a tribunal, also known as the jury, whose decision is final and cannot be appealed. You know, whenever a case is, when they try to appeal a case in, that's written up by, you know, that was under common law through a court of record and presided over by a jury, the only way that they can get any kind of an overturn on that decision is if they can show somehow that an individual's unalienable rights was violated. Then that is the only time the Supreme Court can get involved and try to figure a way to fix that up. Again, it depends on what exactly it is that's going on in the case. But again, that's the only time it could be done. These are the two courts of focus, the equity, courts of equity and courts of law, two of them. The judicial power, and here it is, the authority, the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity, Article 3, Section 2. Courts of equity. Courts of equity are courts not of record and do not have the power to fine or incarcerate. Therefore, they cannot hear criminal cases. They proceed in equity, which is a body of jurisprudence. Okay? And I'd like to read the footnote we have here for jurisprudence. So jurisprudence is the science of law. By science here is understood that connection of truth, which is founded on principle, either evident in themselves or capable of demonstration. It is a collection of truths of the same kind, arranged in methodical order. In a more confined sense, jurisprudence is the practical science of giving a wise interpretation of the laws and making a just application of them to all cases as they arise. In this sense, it is a habit of judging the same question in the same manner and by this course of judgments forming precedents. So there is a science involved here. Certainly nobody should ever be brought, or cannot be brought into a court of equity if it is a criminal offense that's being challenged in here. Okay, let me see where we're at here. All right, the next court, administrative courts. Administrative courts are statutory courts that proceed according to statutes and do not yield to common law and are unalienable rights, and whose end results are the will of the state. These courts do not have the power to fine or incarcerate, even though they do. They don't really have that power. You see, they do it because we're that dumbed down. If the people understood it, we wouldn't allow it to happen. You know, courts had been in check whenever people understood whatever it is that is in view. And they're kept in check, you know. The power of habeas corpus 30, 40, 50 years ago would never be questioned. Okay, it would be really hard for them to hide it, you know, because the people, at least the people involved, knew, okay. But today, you know, the people don't know. They don't have a clue. So they ignore it. They're getting away with it because we've been dumbed down and we're letting them get away with it. That's the only reason they're getting away with it. We're letting them get away with it. Okay, so according to statutes, do not yield to common law and our inalienable rights and whose end results are the will of the state. These courts do not have the power to fine or incarcerate and are called nisi prius courts. People are not obligated to participate in these courts unless they agree first. That's what nisi prius means, unless first. If you agree with it, that's an administrative court. Department of Labor have courts. And then nisi prius courts, people agree to go to them. You participate with that with your employer. You everybody gets into the game. That's where you got into the agreement. Compensation courts, same way, you know. You don't have to go involve yourself in those courts. You can deny them and go right into the Supreme Court and make your battle there. You'll win your position there, depending on if you're making a common law position. You won't win a common law position in those courts. So unless they agree first. The law requires jurisdiction to appear on the record. This is extremely important. If it doesn't appear on the record, guess what? It's a court of record, isn't it? Court of record does not require a court of record being written up on the top appear on the record. It doesn't require that. But a court not of record requires the jurisdiction to be expounded upon, to be exposed, to be told, so that you know what jurisdiction you're in. And they never do that. You know, you go into these town courts, village courts, city courts, even the federal courts, and the state courts, the county courts. Doesn't matter. They should all be all those should be in courts of records, or at least courts of equity. But in criminal, if they bring criminal charges, they got to be courts of record. Yet there is no jurisdiction, and they're in jurisdictions unknown. They don't tell you what jurisdiction you're in. Well, I say let's put the jurisdiction on top of all our papers. Let's let them know this is a court of record proceeding according to the common law. That's how we write every paper that we write here. We have right on the top of the paper, it's even shown in this paper here, they're right in the first page, jurisdiction, court of record, under the rules of the common law. And then we give it a footnote, which we express exactly what a court of record is. The court of record is a judicial tribunal having the attributes and exercising functions independently of the person of the magistrate designed generally to hold it and proceeding according to the course of the common law, its acts and proceedings being enrolled for a perpetual memorial. Jones versus Jones. There it is, right there. That's what a court of record is. Make it clear. Require them to do the same. If they don't, acknowledge the fact that there's nothing on the top. When they respond back to you or they come with the first thing, you can respond right away acknowledging the fact that they're accepting the common law, the jurisdiction, as on the top of your paper since they didn't put it on the top and they didn't let it be known. Then it has to be a court of record. And those are the rules we're going to go by. And start holding their feet to the fire. It's the only way you have any potential of winning any court case. The law requires jurisdiction to appear on the record. Some examples of these kinds of courts are housing courts, Department of Labor courts, compensation courts, village courts, town courts, etc. Congress has not been given authority to legislate statutory courts. Let me repeat that. Congress has not been given the authority to legislate statutory courts. Those powers have been given to the states. But the states are still restricted by Article 6 of the Constitution that all judges must obey. So if they're going to be an administrative court, that's a contractual court. And it can't be a hidden contract. It's got to be up front. You're entering into a court that's a contractual court. Here is the jurisdiction. We're the Department of Labor. You're in our court, in an administrative court. And by the way, our end result is we can't fine you, nor can we incarcerate you at the end of this thing. You see, they really have no power or authority anyway. Yet they do. Why? Because we're ignorant. Jurisdiction of Article 3 courts. Article 3, Section 2. the judicial power, now follow along closely here, of what authority they really have. And again, this paper is up on our website. People should be studying this, and people should be asking questions if they don't understand on our Monday night programs. They should understand. They should be studying and understanding. These memorandums that we're putting up is the key mindset for the winning of any court case. If you want to win a court case, you have to understand the jurisdiction that you're applying in and that you're requiring them to proceed in. And you have every right and authority to require them to proceed. If they're not proceeding in the proper jurisdiction, if they're not proceeding properly, giving you, due process, then you have every right to demand it, to let it be known, wait a second, your jurisdiction is unknown. I don't know where you're coming from. Let me explain the jurisdiction you're in. You've got to constantly be bringing yourself back to the jurisdiction you belong in. You have to constantly be requiring the due process. If they're going to come out after you for anything, you better be giving me due process. And you have to understand that. And you have to be able to recognize when they just moved you into another jurisdiction. You have to understand on what statutes they can bring up and what statutes they cannot bring up. Because, by the way, there are certain statutes we have given them authority to apply. But these normally don't apply to people. They apply ultimately to servants, most statutes. A lot of statutes, the way they're structured, they move. It's almost like how they proceed, how one would proceed in business, so to speak, sort of the rules. And also the consequences if you break these rules, policies and procedures, sort of, in a sense, because they are law, though. Jurisdictions of Article III courts. Article III, Section 2, the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made of which shall be made under their authority. Now listen very carefully, and in all of this, you will find only two jurisdictions. The jurisdiction, one is the jurisdiction of the land, and the other is the jurisdiction of the sea. Those are the only two jurisdictions you're going to find here. Listen carefully. To all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers, and councils. To all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction. To controversies to which the United States shall be a party. To controversies between two or more states. Between a state and a citizen of another state, between citizens of different states, between citizens of the same state claiming lands under grants of different states, and between the states or the citizens thereof and foreign states, citizens or subjects, in all cases affecting ambassadors, other republican ministers, and consuls. Let me make sure I'm not repeating myself here again. And those in which the state shall be party. The Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction in all the other cases before mentioned. The Supreme Court shall have the appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, and such exceptions, and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. The trial of all crimes, except in cases of impeachment, shall be by jury. You hear that? If it's a criminal court, first of all, if it's called a criminal court, it's an administrative court. Jurisdiction's unknown. It certainly is not a court of record. There is no division of courts, one called civil and one called, criminal. That's there, jurisdiction's unknown. Right there, that should immediately alarm you. If it's called a criminal court, you're in the wrong court. They got to fix it because they don't have the power or the authority to hold you in that court. And you got to understand that and understand how to get out of it. The trial of all crimes except in cases of impeachment shall be by jury, and such trial shall be held in the state where the said crime shall have been committed. But when not committed within any state, the trial shall be at such place or places as the Congress may by law have directed. Okay, so there are two jurisdictions inside all of that language. Let's go back. Federal courts, two jurisdictions. Federal courts only have two jurisdictions, the jurisdiction of the sea and of the land. Number one, admiralty and maritime jurisdiction cases where international law applies, law of the sea, under jurisprudence. And that's an important fact. That still brings them back under common law, and that's accepted internationally, or at least it used to be. Again, they're playing games of jurisdiction unknown out on the sea also, in my opinion. Second, law and equity jurisdiction. That's the other jurisdiction, both of which is clearly under the common law. All of other cases above, law of the land, bound by Article 6. And clearly, equity courts are bound by Article 6, just as much as the law courts of law. Courts that resist the Constitution. Judges have a duty by oath to support the Constitution and guarantee a Republican form of government. Any judge acting upon seditious legislation acts, joins the conspiracy of subversion. If then the courts are to regard the Constitution, and the Constitution is superior to any ordinary act of legislation, the Constitution, and not such ordinary act, must govern the case to which they both apply. Those men who resist the principle that the Constitution is to be considered in court as a paramount law are reduced to the necessity of maintaining that court must close their eyes on the Constitution and see only the law. This doctrine would subvert the very foundation of all written constitutions. It would declare that an act, which according to the principles and theory of our government, is entirely void, is yet in practice completely obligatory. It would declare that if the legislature shall do what it is expressly forbidden, such act, notwithstanding the express prohibition, is in reality effectual. It would be given to the legislature a practical and real omnipotent with the same breath which professes to restrict their powers within narrow limits. It is prescribing limits and declaring that those limits may be passed at pleasure. It is in these words, I do solemnly swear that I will administer justice without respect to persons and do equal right to the poor and to the rich, and that I will faithfully and impartially discharge all the duties incumbent on me as according to the best of my abilities and understanding, agreeably to the Constitution and the laws of the United States. Why does a judge swear to discharge his duties agreeably to the Constitution of the United States if that Constitution forms no rule for his government? If it is closed upon him and cannot be inspected by him, if such be the real state of things, this is worse than solemn mockery. To prescribe or to take this oath becomes equally a crime. And this is out of Marbury versus Madison, probably one of the most important cases, if not the most important case. I'll tell you what, United States versus Williams, I think, is up there with this one from the standpoint of really giving us knowledge and understanding and making things clear. But look, this is one of the most important cases in the United States. It's never been overturned, ever. And it is one that everyone should be reading and really, really pull the fruits that you'll find in there. Okay, conclusion. Congress has been given power to create only Article III courts of record and equity courts ruled by American jurisprudence, also known as the United States District Court for the District, or whatever the district is. These courts proceed under the rules of the common law, and all judges are bound to the law of the land and hold office only when they are obedient to the law of the land. And when they're not obedient to the law of the land, you have every right and the power and the authority within that court to remove that judge, to force him to recuse themselves. If they don't correct themselves, they must recuse themselves. If they don't recuse themselves, you can remove them. There is a process. And if you really have to go out after it, there is another process which we're putting together, and it's called suing a court. A superior court can sue an inferior court. Okay? That's in the law. And it's not used very often these days. It is starting to become a little popular and something where, well, I don't want to get too much into discussion because I don't feel confident to be able to really articulate a lot of that stuff yet. But as time comes on, I will because we're studying it now. But that's part of some of the processes that people need to understand to use. Sue the court right there inside that court. Just take them right down. Every officer in there. You know, we talk about that to begin with. We've been talking about that in the past. We've done that out of logic. Now we've come to realize that there's some things out there really supports this, powerful stuff, and particularly Supreme Court rulings on this. And let's use those, and let's go in there and sue the court. We could do this in a criminal case, and that's very interesting, and we will be. Okay, that brings us to the end of that paper, when we get back on to opening up for questions, people can ask some questions. Jen, are there any questions out there that we need to respond to before we move over to Brent? Okay, I guess not. Okay. Silence is acquiesce. I guess we don't have any. Gerard, are you here? Do you have anything to say before we move on?
Silence is acquiesce. Can you hear
me?
There
you go. I hear you.
Okay.
There were no questions.
Oh, wait. Here comes Jen. Oh, yeah, see, now he's coming back in. Go ahead. Do we have anything, Jen?
No, there were no questions submitted this week.
Okay. Is there anybody out there, any leadership there, anything they want to say before we move on? Anybody know about Jen? Do you know anything?
I do not.
Okay, so we'll move on. We're going to move on to Brent. Brent is the author of The Excellence in the Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com, and he's going to take the mic for 20 minutes or so, and then we'll do some Q&As with Brent, and then after that, we'll open the Q&A, and people can ask questions on this paper if they want. But before we move to Brent, just one other thing real quickly. I think next week, we're going to be looking at a memorandum of law in support of jury nullification and the unalienable right of jury independence. This is so important. And, you know, look at these memorandums we're putting together. You know, they may not be perfect, but they lay out everything necessary that you need, the tools, all of the ammunition in order to fight these people and to bring them. They can't respond to this stuff, by the way, and they never will. They never can. They can't. They're just silent. They meet us with silence because they can't argue the point. And so that proves its power to begin with. But look at, you need to set the stage in any case you may have going on. You need to make sure the jurisdiction is known. You need to make them understand that we're in an Article III court in the case of federal courts anyway. You need to make the point that there's a jury involved. The jury is free. You need to make the point that if there's a grand jury involved and this is a criminal court, then, hey, you better make sure that this ain't a tainted jury. We got another paper which should be going up shortly on the grand jury. The one we're going to read next week is probably going to be on the jury. It's a little bit longer than what we've been reading. It's 16 pages, but we're going to go through it, and I'll try not to comment too much on it as we go through. Again, there's a lot of footnotes, so hopefully we get through it within the hour. Brent, you got the mic.
Thanks, John. Again, appreciate the opportunity. And to start out, I want to mention this idea of silence being acquiescence. That's an important concept. And it's always been true in our common law tradition, going back before Magna Carta, but it became well known during the days of Henry VIII. And a fellow by the name of Tom Cranmer, he was a priest at a little country manor, and King Henry VIII was hunting. And, of course, when the king was out hunting, he thought it was his privilege to stop at anybody's house and just demand dinner. So he did. Of course, people claimed they were honored to have him. And this priest was there, who was just a country priest. His name was Cranmer. And the discussion, he wanted to know some things, what this priest thought. And this priest finally said to him, he said, Sire, It is treason for people to take an oath to a foreign sovereign and then claim to be loyal to England. He said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, every priest in England has taken an oath to support and defend the bishop of the town of Rome. How in the world can they then take an oath to support and defend their own country, the law of the land, and even you, when their loyalty is split that way? Well, that got Henry to thinking. And in time, he summoned all of the high muckety-muck prelates in England, about 200 of them, and they were all in a room with him, and he said, you all are guilty of treason. You've taken an oath to a foreign power that is more powerful in your minds, obviously, than your oath to England or to the law of the land or to me. I say you're all guilty. What do you have to say for yourselves? And, of course, as you can imagine, you could have heard a pin drop in the room. Nobody wanted to stick out, and nobody said anything. And he said, after a while, I take your silence as acquiescence. They knew, of course, that for treason, he was known for doing this, as you may remember, he was known for separating people's heads from their bodies for the slightest infractions. Treason, he no doubt would have done it, but he saw more value in them, in their wealth, and they were exceedingly wealthy, and he fined them exceedingly heavy and excused them, but it hurt very much. Well, that's how that became famous, and it is important. Now, when a cop or a police officer or a sheriff's deputy accuses you, that's not the time to say anything. That's the time to remain silent. The time to speak is in the official tribunals, in open court, as our Constitution puts it, respecting treason. There's the time to speak, before the jury, or if there's no jury in a court of equity, before the court. When it comes your time, when you're told that it's time to make an argument, and somebody maybe has filed something against you, filed a paper against you, or a pleading, and alleged certain things, you must speak at that point and answer, or it will be taken as truth. The more I look at the law and government, and the more I look at the true lawgiver and government, the more I see that there are about a dozen grand principles. And no matter what you come across in detail, you should see it in the light of one of those grand first principles. As Hebrews chapter 5 puts it, those first principles, literally, by the letters, according to the Greek text, those unwrought rudiments. Unwrought, that means not touched by the hand of man. In this case, referring to the Ten Commandments, we're talking about the militia. We have been talking about it. Of the several states, to use our Constitution's words, there are four militia clauses our Constitution includes, and each one of those clauses delegates, no, only three of the four clauses delegate a duty respecting the militia of the several states to three classes of people. One of those four militia clauses delegates duties to presidents of the United States. That's the first class. Another of those militia clauses delegates duties to members of Congress, congressmen, including senators. A third militia clause delegates duties to governors and legislators of state government. The fourth militia clause is the foundation of all the militia clauses. It delegates no duties recognizes a God-bestowed duty of self-defense and guarantees that infringement of that duty of self-defense of one's self, one's family, one's neighbors, and one's country, that the general government sitting in Washington, D.C., it guarantees that that government will not infringe, impede, hinder, hamper, chill that right to keep and carry a gun. And I remind you, I think I've mentioned this before, that a right, in old Anglo-Germanic speech, is a duty. Rights are not accompanied by duties. Rights are duties. And it is the duty of every person to take jurisdiction over his relationship with God, over his associations with other people, over his duty to petition government when he believes it's necessary, and it is his duty to keep and carry a military-grade weapon. That's his duty. It is also your duty over your tongue to take jurisdiction, to speak, that's freedom of speech, or not to speak as you believe God would have you do. That's the Fifth Amendment, to not speak, the Fourth Amendment, to speak. The Second Amendment is the fourth militia clause. Granville Sharp was an Englishman, a Brit. I say a Brit after Scotland and England were officially joined, although they had been joined at the hip for centuries. They were officially joined at the beginning of the 18th century. Well, Granville Sharp said this, respecting the common law right to keep and carry a gun. He said, no Englishman can be truly loyal who opposes the principles of English law whereby the people are required to have arms in defense and in peace for mutual as well as private defense. The laws of England have always required the people to be armed, and not only armed, but to be expert in arms. Notice, he does not say the laws of England have always allowed people to be armed. He says the laws of England have always required the people to be armed. That's a monumental statement. And not only armed, but expert in arms. That means at your own expense to get yourself a military-grade weapon, a pistol or a long gun, or both, and then get yourself 500,000 rounds of ammunition. And then make sure that you take, at your own expense, a marksmanship training course, a good one. And there are plenty out there now. Daniel Webster of dictionary fame said nothing will ruin the country if people themselves will undertake its safety. And nothing can save it if they leave that safety in any hands but their own. So let's read this fourth militia clause, better known as the Second Amendment. It says this, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, in some printings of this fourth militia clause, there are commas put in other places. But originally, as far as I can tell, there's only one comma that's sure, and that's the one that divides it into two parts, right after the words, a free state, and right before the words, the right of the people. Our Second Amendment is a crisp and clear statement of our common law tradition's personal right to keep and bear arms, which is our foundation of local peace and national defense. And as the First, Second, Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments, the Second Amendment is brief. Because when it was drafted, no explanation was needed. The framers of our Constitution, says Chief Justice Taft of the U.S. Supreme Court, the framers of our Constitution were born and brought up in the atmosphere of the common law and thought and spoke its vocabulary. When they came to put their conclusions in the form of a fundamental law in a compact draft called our Constitution, they expressed themselves in terms of the common law, confident that they could be shortly and easily understood. What is he saying? He's saying that our Constitution is a brief of common law government. By the way, that's Ex parte Grossman in the year 1925. Therefore, Taft continues, the language of our Constitution cannot be interpreted safely except by a reference to the common law as it was when the instrument was framed and adopted. Now, I've got to correct myself. I jumped the gun, and I attributed that first quote to Taft. That was from the Supreme Court, but it wasn't Taft. The second quote that says the language of the Constitution cannot be interpreted safely except by a reference to the common law as it was when the instrument was framed and adopted, that was Chief Justice Taft. But in either case, they're from Supreme Court justices. Now, those who demanded and those who drafted the Second Amendment revered their English freedoms and knew well that the right to arms is a personal a responsibility rooted deep in the common law. To know the Second Amendment in the context of our common law will correct its misrepresentation. And in this responsibility, the duties of the Second Amendment will become clear and apparent, and I believe they'll be reestablished. Now, during the early days of our common law, earlier as compared to us back a couple of centuries ago, during the threat of the Spanish Armada to England in the year 1588, the students and members of the English Inns of Court formed themselves into companies. Now, the English Inns of Court were the schools of law that common lawyers formed to combat Rome. Rome, of course, controlled the universities and had controlled them all over Europe. And they wouldn't allow the common law to be taught at Oxford. And so they formed four inns of courts in England to combat the law of the city, as the Roman priest promoted it. Well, they formed themselves into companies, armed themselves for the defense of their country, trained themselves in swordsmanship and the handling of firearms, which was a rather new art at that time. And then, having formed themselves into companies and sharpened their handling of arms, they followed a graduate of Lincoln's Inn in England, a fellow by the name of Oliver Cromwell, into battle against the forces of the crown. It was Parliament against the crown. It was the common law against the civil law. It was the law of the land against the law of the city. And, of course, Cromwell and his troops defeated the forces, the civil law forces of the king. And when Napoleon assembled flatboats that belonged to invade Great Britain, these barristers again formed up into companies, and they carried the banner retained for the defense. Now, I tell you these stories to try to demonstrate that the right to keep and carry a gun is a common law right. It arises and is undergirded by our common law. Take away our common law, and the right to keep and carry a gun goes with it. And that is why we are a country, because British troops made an attempt to take the guns of the militiamen in the colonies, specifically that of Massachusetts, and that's what sparked the war that brought our separation from the country of England and Britain. They said the common law does not apply in the American colonies. That was what even William Blackstone said in his first volume of his commentaries on the laws of England, his commentaries, as it is sometimes said, on the common law. Blackstone was a good man. He even supported what the colonies were doing, but he was misinformed and misunderstood. He said, the common law does not apply in our American colonies. Well, our American plantations, to quote him. But if the common law does not apply in the American colonies, two things inevitably follow from that. Number one, there is no right to keep and carry a gun. Number two, slavery is okay. And by the way, that was the fly in the ointment. And that is how slavery got started in the colonies. And that was the inconsistency of what we had here. Because England said, we're planting these colonies, and although the colonists always said the common law applied here, Parliament and Englishmen that were in power didn't want that. They were making a lot of money on their tobacco plantations and their cotton plantations and their sugarcane plantations in the Caribbean and up along the southern coast in Florida of the United States. And so that was an inconsistency. England did away with the slave trade. Slavery never existed as a matter of law in England, but it did exist in all of her colonies, and that was lawful. And when she did away with the slave trade, that didn't necessarily do away with slavery in the colonies. Didn't have to worry about England. But the tradition of individual rights to keep and bear arms, coupled with personal responsibility of discipline for their use, apart from government, that's our common law tradition, carried into the United States. Listen, if we're to depend upon government, as they do in Switzerland, to provide our arms, that's not common law militia. That's not the furred fare of the Danes and Anglo-Saxons. And that's not freedom. We don't want to depend upon government to provide our arms, the arms of the militia. That's what the Dick Act 120 years ago got around to doing, almost 120 years. And that's what the National Guard did, you see. And the oath of the National Guard is not to your state. It's to the federal government. That causes a problem. Now, when the militia of any separate state is called into national service by the president, whoever the president may be, then the oath is administered at that time. The oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. I'm not saying it couldn't be administered before. It probably ought to, but it had not ought to be administered an oath. An oath to, had not ought to be administered that requires, as military men today, obedience to the lawful orders of the President of the United States. That could come later and should come later when they're called in, summoned, and mustered into national service, if that ever happened. But before that happens, then their oath should be to the Constitution of the United States, nothing wrong with that, but also to the Constitution of their state, and to lawful orders of the governor of their state. That must be included. And whoever calls them out first has jurisdiction over them, whether it be the governor of their state or the president. That's the law of our Constitution. In 1814, Britain's seasoned army, by the way, this was the army that had defeated Napoleon at Waterloo. They were seasoned to battle, and they were a victorious army. That's what catapulted Britain into super world power. Well, that same army, and even many of the same men, Andy Jackson defeated at New Orleans, or near Bouts, New Orleans. And he went into the city of New Orleans when he finally and he was guessing. He knew they'd land either in Mobile or New Orleans. He figured New Orleans because he had an intelligence report from somebody on a British warship that there had been seen aboard the warships, trunks carrying women's clothing. And so he concluded that the wives of some of the officers were aboard, and they wouldn't land at Mobile, Alabama, if that's the case, because there was nothing to do there, no restaurants to go to, no place to entertain high-class, high-toned ladies. And his guess was right. He just guessed. He went to New Orleans. Sure enough, they showed up downriver. But he defeated them using, by and large, militiamen from his own state and other states, and he impressed every able-bodied man within the jurisdiction and area of the city of New Orleans into service. And when he did that, people voluntarily organized themselves into companies of men with whom they had camaraderie. And they put themselves under oath under Jackson, and of course the rest is history. That's what can happen. People shouldn't say that militiamen cannot be effective fighters. They can, and they did. They didn't defeat any army. They defeated the greatest army on the face of the planet in one battle. Well, I jumped ahead a little bit. Of course, I'd mentioned about England saying, and the lawyers and Parliament and others saying, the common law didn't apply here. The Americans were victorious, and these were largely, of course, beleaguered farmers and artisans of several kinds. They just kept at it for 7-8 years until they got the job done. But when they put the Second Amendment in our Constitution, this Fourth Militia Clause, they felt it to be more than a reasoned conclusion. They were convicted that it was a necessity. And as they pondered the National Bill of Rights, called the first 10 amendments to our Constitution, the smell of gunpowder from Lexington and Concord, says Les Adams, still hung in their noses. This was no theory. This was no legal idea that they conjured up in their minds reading books in musty libraries. They lived it. They understood it. They themselves were lucky to come through it alive. Many of them that signed the Declaration of Independence didn't. They were hunted down like wolves and killed. They had bounties on their heads. And they didn't want anybody to infringe upon the personal right to keep and carry a gun. They saw, Americans at that time saw, the Second Amendment gave teeth to their other personal freedoms in the Bill of Rights, encouraging boldness to speak freely, to write freely, to associate freely. Indeed, the Second Amendment was there, as they knew its meaning, had suffered long during its passage, and tolerated nothing less than each person's natural right to arms and private discipline in their use. And thus, without a hint of objection, they added the Second Amendment to the Constitution. They didn't argue about it and received no fanfare. It was the natural thing to do. Moreover, our common law tradition, I must add this is a grand principle, had always understood rights as an individual and personal matter, never a collective matter. Listen to William Blackstone. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. He did make a big mistake about the colonies, but he wasn't against the colonies. He said this: the public good is in nothing more essentially interested than in the protection of every individual's private rights. The public good is in nothing more essentially interested than in the protection of every individual's private rights. There are no public rights, friends, neighbors, and kin. There are only individual rights. And the public good is best protected by protecting private rights. And by this principle, James Madison structured the Second Amendment. Now watch me on this. The public good, that is the security of a free state, depends upon our keeping the individual right to keep and bear arms from infringement. You see, there's the private right brings us, the private right being the right to keep and bear arms, brings to us the public good, the security of a free state, to quote the Second Amendment. Justice Joseph Story, champion of our common law and of our Constitution, called the Second Amendment the palladium of our liberties, the palladium, since it offers a strong moral check against the usurpation and arbitrary power of rulers. A palladium is something that is a symbol and the reality of a thing. The right to keep and bear arms, the Second Amendment, is the symbol of Americans as free people. Take that away, you've taken away the symbol of our freedom. You've also taken away, though, our freedom. It serves as both. And Justice Story understood in his day the necessity of the Second Amendment. But also, he foresaw the great danger creeping toward it, the danger now facing us, a gradual undermining, a gnawing at its foundation of personal right. In a word, infringement. There is, said Story, certainly no small danger that indifference may lead to disgust, and disgust to contempt, and thus gradually undermine all the protection intended by this clause of our National Bill of Rights. Identifying the danger, Justice Story forewarns us. Taking heed, we will fulfill the Second Amendment's purpose. Real national security, and never forget, to be forewarned is to be forearmed. He has forewarned us. Are we forearmed? Well, that's all I have for this evening. I've got a lot of quotes here. I could do those later. But that's enough for this evening concerning the Second Amendment. And I thank you again for letting me unload what I've learned. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, Brent. We'll open up now for people who might want to have some questions. Let's open up the chat. Anybody who has any questions or comments for Brent, hit star 6, get into the queue, and ask your questions or make your comments. Star 6, get into the queue. Okay, we have our first caller. Let's see. I think it's Fred from California. Is that you, Fred?
Yes, sir.
Go right ahead. What do you have for Brent?
Well, it's a question about these people that diesel these inmates all around the country. And what I thought about was the fact that even though they're in federal custody, these people are traveling across state jurisdictions and county jurisdictions. And it seems to me that the sheriff is a supreme law enforcement officer in any county, irrespective of what jail this person might be in. And his care could be inquired. That sheriff has every right to see that man and see his well-being. Yeah, that's my personal opinion. I wanted to give this to Brent. Maybe he could expound upon jurisdiction and how or you can explain to him about the dieseling of these inmates.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is this. It is the duty of an American to arrest a man if he feels he is capable of doing so, to arrest a man in the act of committing a felony. And that's the law. That's the common law standard. It's true, as far as I know, in every state. You even are tested on it on law exams. Doesn't happen real often. But if it's true that an American has a duty, if he's able, I realize that my father is 90 years old. I don't think that he'd want to take that up, probably. Now, if he had a gun in his hand, I think he could, maybe. And in any case, I know he'd want to. But if that's true of every American, how much more so is that true of a sheriff sworn to uphold the law within his territorial jurisdiction? Now, as far as dieseling men go, that's a rough case in this, and I know it goes on. I've seen it. I've seen a lot of other things like it. But if you stop a bus that's dieseling people for days on end to the point that they're killing them, as they did to that congressman that wrote that book to harass our people a number of years ago, if they're doing that, how can you prove they're doing it? In other words, what bus will you stop? How do you know what's on the inside? Now, here's another question. What right under the Fourth Amendment does a sheriff have to stop a bus owned by the Congress of the United States? And the Congress, by the way, has ultimate power over property of the United States. What right would they have under the Fourth Amendment to stop and do a search? They would have to have, a sheriff would have to, my humble opinion at the least, have a good warrant issued by a neutral and detached magistrate. And this brings to mind what I'd like to say, and I'll say it now, I like to say it every time I'm on, the only remedy for lawlessness is law. And therefore, and the only law of the land there is due process. That is the law of the land. It is the encompassing principle of all of the law of the land, is due process. That is our common law above all things. If the sheriff's going to do something like that, he better have a warrant from a neutral and detached magistrate, as our Fourth Amendment requires, upon oath or affirmation. It must be reasonable at all points, and he must execute it according to the law. He must provide an inventory after he takes whatever he wants to take or seizes what person he wants to seize. That's the standard in America, is due process. And in this case, I would think a warrant would be in order, because he would be investigating the personal property of another. Just like he'd be stopping anybody else on the road, he'd have to have a warrant to break into his vehicle, break into his trunk. He'd have to have a warrant to be lawful, I like to say, because it does happen without warrants, as we all know. That's lawlessness, and it will destroy us. That's pretty much my first impression about and my response to that kind of an idea.
Okay, thank you, Brent. Thank you, Fred. We'll take our next caller. Terry from New Jersey. Oh, I hit the wrong button. Well, that's the first time I did that, Gerard. Anyway, Q&A is, let me open the Q&A back up. I apologize for that. It was Terry was up there first, so if you want to try to get back in there quickly, I'll try to pull you up there. Star 6, Terry, and anybody else that was in the queue. Star 6, there were only a couple people left in the queue, but let me take Terry first, and then we'll take Rhonda. Go right ahead, Terry. You got the mic. Can you hear? Let me try this. Go ahead, Terry. You got the mic.
Hi. This question is directed to Brent. I bought all your books, by the way. I just got to find some time.
Can you get a little closer to your mic?
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yes. I bought all of Brent's books. I just got to find time to read them. But I have a question about an author who is, his books are often sold alongside yours. I'm not going to mention a name, but you probably know who he is. And he wrote a book about commercial liens. And I was wondering what you thought about the commercial lien process, because I know that, for example, that's what the IRS uses against us. Is it possible to use that against some of these corrupt judges and prosecutors out there?
Oh, I read cases where that's happened, and I don't. And the book, I'm not familiar with. My book sold in a lot of places. Different catalogs have it, and people, and I don't. I'm not able to keep up with all the books that are sold alongside it. The commercial lien has been used. I read cases in the cases that I've read where the commercial lien has been used, the folks that did it, it was as though they declared war on the government and the government came down. That's what I remember about those cases. I'm not saying that that was lawful. I'm just saying that's what happens. You know, when we go in, when you face off, the Bible says, do not square off. I'm quoting Jesus Christ, the Sermon on the Mount. The old English translation says, do not resist evil. Well, that's weak and doesn't really say anything, doesn't even make any sense. Of course you're supposed to resist evil. But what the Greek text really says is, do not square off with evil. That means don't draw a line in the sand and say, you're going to do this to me, I'm going to do that to you. You're going to bust me in the chops, we'll hold still, and I'll bust you in the chops. And we'll just punch each other as hard as we can, and we'll see who goes down first. Don't do that. You'll lose. As I like to say, these are the people that have aircraft carriers, not to mention the U.S. Marine Corps. And when you go into battle, this is a guerrilla warfare game. We have courts, and to go into court and expect the court to follow the law is naivety. It won't happen. And if it does happen, it certainly won't happen at every point. And to go into court and think the courts are not going to go along with the federal government or the state government, that's naivety too. And I'll quote Justice Scalia on that. Justice Scalia said he gets tired of, he's not alive now, but he said he used to get tired of people writing him letters telling him that he ought to do more and the court ought to do more, the Supreme Court, of supporting state rights. And he said this, you got to understand who pays my salary. When I get my paycheck, it says Treasury of the United States. Why would you look to me to support state rights, states' rights? Our Constitution, he continued, he was a realist at this point, our Constitution is established and ordered so that states protect state rights and judges protect their jurisdiction and their own courts. That was another question I didn't follow up on not too many weeks ago. Judges hold people in contempt, and somebody said, well, where do they get the authority to do that? They get the authority to do that, and it's an ancient authority, going back before Magna Carta, according to Sir Edward Coke. But they get the authority to do that because when a person is delegated jurisdiction to do a job, that means he's delegated a right, a responsibility, a duty. And along with every duty that is delegated to every individual comes the inherent duty to defend that jurisdiction. And when a judge holds somebody in contempt, at least this is the idea, the ideal, I should say, with an L on the end. When a judge holds somebody in contempt, he's doing so in defense of the order and the good going and the good doing of his jurisdiction. That's an inherent right. God made the world that way. You say, well, he does it in a way of which I do not approve. It probably does. I've seen that. He is an arbitrary, vengeful man. Well, yeah, that happens a lot too. Men at their best, as old Ryle used to say, are only men at best, and that ain't saying much. And men are just men. That's why we have juries, because judges are nothing but, and I'm quoting Justice Scalia here, nothing but lone employees of the state. So we all must look to ourselves, and this was Justice Scalia's point, and this was Justice Jackson's point of the U.S. Supreme Court. He said this. He said, a man's rights are only as good as he is convicted they should be, or as some lawyer is convicted that he has retained ought to be. And bottom line, a man's rights are only as good as he decides he wants to make them, either by defending them himself or retaining a lawyer to help him do that. And to do that, you have to have conviction to shell out money. Very difficult. But that, I hope I hit the nail on the head, or with my head, or both. But
okay.
That's what I've got to say about that.
All right, thank you, Brent. Okay, thank you, Terry. Let's take our next caller, which would be, looks like Rhonda. Let me make sure I don't hit the wrong. You know, I didn't hit the wrong one before. I don't know why that went out, but okay, let's try this. Rhonda, you should have the mic. Go right ahead. Wonderful Washington.
Hi, this is Rhonda, Washington State. What I would like to ask of Brent is, would he please delineate the articles and sections in the Constitution that correspond to each of the four causes of the militia so we know which one is the authority for each?
Well, yeah, that's a good idea because and we did this and we went along. I tried to repeat them over and over again. So I want to say I tried, but then as time went on, I thought, well, I better quit repeating them. People get tired of me doing that. But I'll go over them real quickly here. The first militia clause is Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 15 through 16. Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 15 through 16 says this: the Congress shall have the power to provide for the calling forth of the militia, to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. To provide also for the army, and organizing army, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. That's Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 15 through 16. That's the first militia clause, and it has to do with powers delegated to Congress respecting the militia of the several states. The second militia clause has to do with the authority, the jurisdiction of the states, respectively. That means the legislatures and the governor. It says this: reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. That's Article 1, Section 8, Clause 16. Follows hard on this clause that pertains to Congress. And the chief salient point of this clause is that the appointment of officers belongs to the states, not to the federal government. Jefferson Davis, graduate of West Point, president of the Confederacy later, before that he was offered an appointment to the militia of his state by an army officer, I believe, I won't say who it was, I can't remember for sure, and by maybe it's President Millard Fillmore, but he refused it, saying that the Constitution forbids the federal government from appointing militia officers. He was right. The third militia clause pertains to the president. His delegated duty says this: the president shall be commander-in-chief of the militia of the several states, caveat, when called into actual service of the United States. You see, the president of the United States is not commander-in-chief of the militia of the several states until he summons them by summoning each individual member that he wants to summons into actual service to the United States. And it is the opinion of Justice Joseph Story in his commentaries on the Constitution that he doesn't take jurisdiction over such militiamen until he musters and says present. And that is good law, I think. So that's the first militia clause, pertains to Congress. The second militia clause pertains to the state governments. The third militia clause pertains to that class of persons called presidents. And the fourth militia, third militia clause is Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1. Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1. And then the fourth militia clause is the well-known Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution.
Thank you.
So that's Article 1, Article 1, Section... Let me repeat those just so others may get them. Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 15 and 16. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 16. Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1. And then the Second Amendment.
Okay,
thank you for the question,
Rhonda. Okay, let's take our next caller. It looks like Veronica from Pennsylvania. Is that correct? Is it Veronica from PA?
Yes.
How you doing? Go right ahead. You got
yes.
the mic.
Yes, it's me. I can't unmute.
No, you're unmuted. You're okay. We can hear you. I've unmuted you. Go right ahead. Maybe she muted herself back.
Yep.
She did.
You muted yourself, Veronica.
Yeah, let me try doing this. Let me get it. Let's see. Go ahead, try now, Veronica. Oh, no, we lost Veronica.
You've got me, a California
I got
Fred
back. Veronica, get back into the queue. Let me get Veronica first, Fred. Hang on right a second. Hang on a second. Let me just get her first. Okay, let's try Veronica now. Okay, what happened here?
Okay.
Oh, there she goes. Go ahead. Yes,
yeah, I don't know why, you know, my machine was not cooperating. I've heard the term dieseling brought up, and I haven't heard what I've heard in the past about dieseling. And dieseling, as I was told by a prisoner when I was doing vocational rehabilitation counseling, what I found out from him is that dieseling was the transporting of prisoners from one private prison to another in order that that private prison would appear to be full when the funding came.
Well, I'm sure that's part of it. I mean, they'll get every bit of mileage they can out of it, but in the meantime, and it is true, some people are dieseled just to destroy their physical ability to resist or to speak, and to teach them that you don't mess with organized crime. That happens.
Exactly.
Too.
And he had, you know, also mentioned that too. And that was in the early 90s. So, I mean, this has gone back a long ways that they've been doing this.
Oh, I'm sure. So they have been doing it for a long time. True.
Sure. And as a counselor that got these people who were coming out of prison, yes, there was a lot of problems that they were dealing with. Anyway, thank you. Just wanted to put that in there. That's another aspect of dieseling. Okay.
All right. Thank you, Veronica. Okay, that
thank
brings
you.
Us to end of our Q&A for Brent. Brent, we appreciate your time, and if you want to hang around, maybe someone else has something. You can always mute and unmute yourself if you want to pipe in.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to move over. Gerard, you here? Gerard? Someone hit that shock button to get him motivated.
Unmute. Doesn't like to work. It doesn't,
okay, well, you,
it doesn't like to acquiesce.
Oh, okay. So you got it. Go right ahead. I'm not going to touch the controls. I'll let you take the controls. Anybody else who wants to get into the queue to ask any questions? Star 6 to get into the queue. Go ahead, Gerard.
Okay, it looks like...
You had to hit the next question. There you go.
Yeah,
yep.
I did. We got David, if it's David.
Hello, this is Dave Missouri. I'm a Johnny come lately tonight. I had a project I was working on and forgot all about the conference. Anyhow, as I listened when I first got on there, they're talking about dieseling people. And I looked that up on the internet, and sometimes they have no... absolutely no destination whatsoever. It's more, Brett probably has already covered this factor, that they just do it to wear the poor bastard down and, you know, wear him out and make him suffer. That's exactly what they do it for. I talked about a couple different prisoners that wrote comments on this blog that I was looking at, and said that they experienced this. They actually landed up where they began at, but they must have traveled thousands of miles to do it, if that makes any sense to anybody but the federal government. Anyhow, I just thought I'd throw that Penton's in there. If he's already covered it, fine. If not, if you go to the internet and just Google the word diesel, diesel therapy is what I Googled, and that's what I came up with. I'll back to you now.
Well, the fact that Google has a definition on it means it's time to stop, because that means it's common knowledge now.
Yeah, that's so true.
You know what I mean?
We need
somebody...
to. What was it? He Googled the diesel what? The therapy?
Diesel therapy.
Diesel therapy.
Up. Yeah. And they just run them around and around and around thousands of miles and bring them back home. You know?
Go ahead.
Somebody's given an order to do that. Now, that's where's those orders coming from? I mean, look at the guy driving the bus. He's getting tortured too.
I think it's the guy running the jail. That's what they told me. If I'm still alive with on your phone, it's the guy running the jail. So he's the one that's giving the orders.
That's what I would think, that the warden is responsible. And look, if you have to move a prisoner, they usually fill a habeas corpus out to go from one state to another or from one court to another. I mean, where's the habeas corpus to move this guy? If they're changing prisons, I don't know what the process is there. But, you know, obviously he's getting an order, and maybe the warden's getting an order from above. Who knows? Who's telling the warden to take that prisoner and diesel him? It's such a common process that they just accept it. Oh, take prisoner number 632 and run him around the country for a month. You know what I mean? So, obviously, the buck does stop with the warden, is where I would think. And if you can make the warden sing, we can hold these wardens' feet to the fire to find out what they're doing and why, in a suit maybe. You know, they might sing and say, well, it came from above. What am I going to do? It came out of the White House. It came out of whatever, you know what I mean? It would be interesting to see what kind of fallout we could get from that. But look, you know, it's almost a suit that all prisoners could take up on their own. A class action suit or a civil rights suit or whatever you want to call it. This is a common practice now that Google even has a definition for. I don't know, it sounds pretty ripe to me, you know?
So yeah, I agree with that, Gerard. I'm out here on, you know, Google right now, and I'm over into Wikipedia, which has a definition for diesel therapy, and I'm going to collect some information and put it into a file here. We're going to be dealing with the Robinson case this week, and we're going to bring this up, that we are under the impression and understanding from sources, various sources, that this is what they're doing to Joe Robinson out there in Montana, who is an extremely ill individual that suffered a stroke not too long ago and is under doctor's care and medications, and yet he's not receiving it during this process. He can't take this kind of pressure and treatment, and it is for the sole purpose, I think, to kill him. And I think, I'll tell you what, if this man does die, and we discovered for sure he was in this kind of a situation, as far as I'm concerned, I'm going to bring it to the grand jury for murder. Because they're doing this on purpose, and hopefully we'll be able to stop this, and hopefully he's not going to die from this, and we'll save his life, first of all. Second of all, there's no reason why they shouldn't release him immediately, because he has proven himself to be a person who would show up for court, even for sentencing he came in. He doesn't have any past background problems. He's not an alcoholic or a drug addict. It doesn't involve any serious crimes of anything of the past he's never been involved with, and the crime that he's accused of is digging a hole. And so he's going through an appeal process, which I'm convinced we're going to bypass the appeal process and do something totally different in this case for him. And, of course, it's an uphill battle, but nevertheless, we're going to do what we got to do. We've already put a paper in for him concerning the fact that he should be released, because you know what? When you go in and read the statute that is written, if he falls into a certain category going for an appeal, in this case particularly, the whole case looks like there's a good chance to be thrown out. That also is a sort of a point on his side for release. But you know what? The law ultimately says that unless the government can prove there's a good reason, dangerous to the community, may not show up, a flight risk, unless they can prove any of those things, the law requires his release. And that's true with every case, and they never do it. You know, that's true with the fact that if they can't prove any of those things, they can't even hit him up for a bond. Of course, if it was a violent act or something that he's being accused with and they got some good evidence, blah, 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 you know, then maybe, yeah, you can make the argument that a bond of some kind, you know, bail should be put up. But in his case, there was no violence. In his case, a very weak case, and many other things, clearly a political case. There's absolutely no reason why he shouldn't have been released. Yet, instead of releasing him, they're shipping him around like this, trying to kill him. And I think these people, the judge, right on down, every single one of them, they think they're immune, they're not. We can show that clearly, even in our own, even in the statutes that they claim to believe in, which they never uphold themselves. Even with those statutes, we can show and prove a case, the fact that they can be held liable and they have to suffer the consequences. And you know what? Murder is murder. I don't care who they are. If we go out after them for murder, if it is something that they plan to do and they're doing it and he dies, we're going to go for murder, I think. I don't see any way to get around. Of course, it's up to the grand jury to make that decision, not me. But that's what I would ask the grand jury to go out and consider. Anyway, back to you, Gerard. Gerard, you're muted. Either that or you fell asleep.
No, you've got me again, California Fred, and I had another question for Brent.
Yeah, go right ahead, but Gerard should be back on the line.
Yeah, I was muted. I didn't realize it. Go ahead.
Do you want to handle me first? Thank you, sir. I'm on.
Yeah, you just go ahead. You're in the queue. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, get a little closer to your mic.
Yeah, you're kind of low.
A little far away.
My question was, again, for Brent, and he said, for a felony, citizen's arrest. And that's interesting in this. The Constitution spells out high misdemeanors, high crimes, and treason. There's no mention of felony. When did the word felony become part of the Constitution? And not only that, the benchmark for a felony seems to keep lowering and lowering and lowering, while the crime felony becomes more egregious, and they take away rights. How can that be?
Yeah, anyway. Yeah, I agree, Fred. Look, you could drive your car with no insurance on it, and they could charge you a felony for that. Imagine that.
Well, that's today, but it wasn't 10 years ago, and this is...
No, I'm just saying, it's ridiculous. Who are they protecting? The insurance company? Who's the injured party? You go out on the street and the cop pulls you over and you find out that for some reason your insurance is lapsed. They don't usually do it, but that is technically a felony charge. They don't never give it for that, you know, but the potential is there. So in other words, if they don't like you or something.
And then they have what they call enhancements. Now, what's an enhancement? Where is that written anywhere?
Yeah, I don't know.
Probably, you know, if Brent's still here, maybe he can comment on some of this. I know that.
The definition of felony has been mushy and fluid over the centuries. And what was a felony is in the first instance, when it first became a popular word, it's a Latin word. It's not an English word, and it came from the imprint of Rome. And the invasion of the Romanized Normans, and they brought it with them. And instead of saying high crime, that's an old, that's more of an Anglo idea. But the idea was kind of the same, but the felony was amounted to when a person lost his land. It was a wrong for which a person lost his land. His rights in land. I shouldn't say land, because when you have land, what you really have is a bundle of rights, as our law says, in that piece of property, a right to grow crops, or a right to mine minerals, or a right, and by the way, we only divide land rights up that way in common law countries. They don't do that in the rest of the world the way we do it. Around home, where I come from, if you buy a piece of land, the first thing you better look at is whether you've got the mineral rights and all the other timber rights and the surface rights. But if you lost rights in land, any right in land, you did some wrong that the law said you lose your rights in land, that was called a felony. But as was said a minute ago, now there's felonies just because some legislature somewhere says it's a felony. Well, what's a felony? Well, the definition then went to, well, it's not losing land, it's anything for which punishment is a year or more in jail. That's after jails became popular. They weren't always popular. Used to, you'd get less than 40 lashes or get pillared in the stocks for a few hours or something, or had to pay a fine or whatever. But if it wasn't at least a year in jail, it wasn't a felony. That definition is still used, about a year in jail. So when you see the word felony, just understand that a felony is according to the arbitrary, imperious breath of legislators, or maybe somebody else in another country. But it's important, that's why I say, because there's so much lawlessness now, and because we've lost our anchor, and because we're on a sea of subjectivity, where everybody's ideas are supposed to be equal, Islamic law, demonism, sodomy, let's use the right word here, and all the other forms of thievery, whether made legal according to man's law or not, we must at this point, and if we don't do it, we're going to be ruled by the law of Islam, or we're going to be ruled by the law of Rome, or we're going to be ruled by the law of the Pharisee, or all three in one, all three of them the same under different labels. But if you have a different God, you're going to have a different law. They have a different God. Their law is not our law. Their law is the law of the evil empire, the law of Babylon. And we have the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. Let's look to those to define what a high crime is. I find it fascinating. I was thinking about this morning. Our Constitution talks about high crimes and misdemeanors. And you can impeach a president, a judge, or some federal officer for high crimes and misdemeanors. Well, that part of our Constitution's a bit humorous, because if you're going to impeach somebody from office and then throw him out of office, that teach me to catch him by the foot, and then you try him for some high crime or misdemeanor. If you're going to do that, you'd think it'd be for a high crime, but no, they included misdemeanors. And the reason they did that is because they wanted to make sure that you could get rid of them for anything, the legislative body could, for anything if they thought it was necessary. It's a misdemeanor to be drunk on the bench. That's a misdemeanor. It's a misdemeanor, I would say, to curse, to let out a string of curse words while you're sitting on the bench of a federal or state court. But I'd say that's an impeachable offense. And, in fact, Tom Jefferson pushed for the impeachment of a judge who was drunk on the bench and liked to let out strings of cuss words. And this particular judge challenged him to a duel, said he was entitled to right to trial by battle. Jefferson never responded, and as far as I know, he was impeached. I just remember the man's name. He was a federal judge. But our Constitution has made it easy for the Congress or the state legislature, as the case may be, to get rid of judges that are not following the law, that are not fulfilling the standard of our common law to be a judge. And that standard, Magna Carta says it beautifully, he must, number one, know the law of the land. What is the law of the land? Due process. He must know it. And that takes a good bit of attention and experience. Everybody can know something about it, but of course, as men get older and work with it, they know more. Well, he must know. That doesn't mean he must know about due process, the law of the land. That means he must know it. That doesn't mean, well, the second part of that says this. He must know it, number one. Number two, he must mean to observe it well. He must have it in his innermost desire, that's called your heart, to do what it demands. Just because a fellow graduates from law school and was on law review and has served as a state or federal judge and clerk for a state or federal judge for a long time, that does not mean that he's qualified to be a judge. He may know due process well. He may know the law of the land. But that does not mean that he has an innermost desire, his heart, that he means to observe it well. And I've observed that judges don't mean to observe it well. I challenge anybody to make a valid argument that says that the right of one man to sodomize another under the status of marriage is the law of the land, in other words, due process. I challenge anybody to even come close to putting up any kind of proof that that's true. That's what our Supreme Court of the United States says. Well, that tells me, as Judge Posner made clear about himself on the Seventh Federal Circuit, they may know the law of the land. They do not mean to observe it well. No, they want to supplant it. They want to put another law in place. They want to say that all these, and I say crazy, utterly crazy ideas are the law of the land, when the truth is sodomy has nothing to do with due process. Nothing. And that's what the law of the land is. So those two requirements are important for judges. And high crimes and misdemeanors allow sufficient reason to easily get rid of them if the legislature would but do it. I'm done.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you, Brent.
I'm not
Thanks,
done.
Brent,
I've got
for that.
Wait, I'm not done.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you can do a citizen's arrest for a felony, but what is the difference between a citizen's arrest for a high crime? I mean, where do you discern
you make an excellent point. The word high crime isn't used today. Nowadays, we talk about felonies. In every state, you'd have to look at the state what constitutes a felony in the state in question. And use the word felony. If you search this out, don't use the word high crime, because high crime is in our constitutional understanding and our common law understanding. But usually high crimes had to do with, were equivalent to felonies. But what the state legislature says today is a felony may not have been a felony at that time. It may have been only a misdemeanor.
Okay.
That's why I say, if you really want to know what a high crime is, go back to the Bible. God's very precise describing what criminal jurisdiction is. And smoking a joint of marijuana is not a high crime. It's not a felony. Or even buying it. The criminal jurisdiction, the Bible does not give criminal jurisdiction to men. As stupid as it may be, and as dangerous as it may be, doing drugs and drinking booze. God doesn't give criminal jurisdiction to men over those matters. We were dumb enough to try it here in America by constitutional amendment. And that's what created, by the way, the power of the FBI and all of the other alphabet soup federal bureaucracies that we now have. That's the foolish. That's what happens when you cross the lines of God and give to men, the governments of men, the jurisdiction, criminal jurisdiction, that God never authorizes by his laws of nature or his laws of nature's God. You pay for it, and we're paying for it. Our own stupidity. Our own lawlessness.
How do we bring back the clock? You see, everything we're trying to do here is under the common law. So where can we find the jurisprudence? I remember that John Duresh was having a great deal of trouble trying to find jurisprudence on the common law. Where can we obtain that?
Well, the first thing you'd want to do is find a fundamental book on comparative law. Comparative law, that's the key word. For years, comparative law was required to be taught in the law schools of America. And in England, they always understood the difference, and they compare and contrast. Comparative law is comparing and contrasting the law of the land and the law of the city. Well, you say, what about other kinds of law? Sharia law, that's the law of the city. What about Roman law? That's the law of the city. It's all the same. So comparative lawyers in common law country have boiled it down to just two things. And there is fundamentally no other law in the world, never has been, never will be, except the law of the land and the law of the city. And I'm in the company of men much more learned and studied than myself through the ages and until recently, who have said the same thing. They've seen the same thing. There is nothing else. Get a good text on comparative law. You cannot understand the common law except as it is compared to its great antagonist, the law of the city, in its many nefarious forms. There are good comparative law texts. Now, I talked about Blackstone a while ago. The four volumes of Blackstone, you can get them in paperback. I suggest you get them in paperback so you can take a pen and rip them apart. Take it slow, read a couple of pages a day, get through it. Some of it will bore you, but you'll start to see in different places the day you think, oh, I've got to read another page of this boring book, and all of a sudden something will jump out at you, and it'll bite you right on the nose, and you'll say, I've been looking for that.
the difference. I see the difference. And you begin to see this grand difference. Everything's divided into two, heaven and hell, heaven and earth, saints and ain'ts, and the law of the land and the law of the city. And this has been observed through the centuries. This is nothing new. But to understand our common law and to see what the fundamentals of it is, there are two things you can do. John Wycliffe said this, and he had an ambition to do two things. He said, England will never change. They were being taken over by the law of the city. That was in the 14th century. They were worried because the Norman law and the priests were, the priesthood and the shambles of the priesthood, wolves in sheep's clothing, were putting the law of Rome in the place of the court slowly, like they're doing here in America. And Wycliffe said this, I've got a two-part plan. The common law has to be taught in the University at Oxford, number one. It's not, it never has been. Number two, I've got to get the Bible into the English tongue so the boy that walks behind the plow can read it. I've got to get the Bible in the mental sod of every rank-and-file Englishman. I've got to get the common law in Oxford. He got the Bible into English, and the benefits of that are immeasurable throughout the world. What happened? And other people started putting the Bible in their own language, took it from the Latin. He didn't have the original text at that time, but you can still read Wycliffe's translation. But the second thing he wanted to do was get the common law in Oxford. It didn't happen from the 14th century until the year 1765 when Blackstone delivered his lectures on the laws of England at Oxford. But even then, he had to deliver them under the ruse of delivering lectures on the law of the city, the civil law. Isn't that amazing? That's how hard it is to overcome the viciousness of evil. But him being a common lawyer, he had studied both laws. He was a student at Oxford. He was a student of the Inns of Court. And he got in there, and by a ruse, he delivered. And he compares, if you read him, throughout, he compares the laws of England with the civil law, and then he published it as the laws of England, and we have it today. You can read that book. Another book you can read is my book, a comparative law text of 1,000 pages. It may be more interesting because it's not written in Old English, older English, I should say, as Blackstone, although you can understand Blackstone. The book I'm talking about is Excellence of the Common Law, compared and contrasted with Roman civil law. That's the name of the book. With the civil law, the law of the land versus the law of the city. I traced the two from the founding of the law of the city at the settling of the city of Babylon on through every continent, section by section. I've written it in sections like sliced bread. You can go through the table of context if you like and pull out the section you like. But if not, start in the beginning and just start reading. You might find it's more fun that way. But if you just start pulling out slices of bread, if you just keep doing that, pretty soon one thing will lead to another, and you'll have been through the book, and you will have a grasp, maybe, God willing, I think you will, of our common law. I'd say this about the book that I wrote, and I wrote it in the spirit of John Fortescue from the 14th century. He wrote a similar book comparing the laws of France with the laws of England. And if you do that, I think you'll get a grasp of the two. You have to see the contrast to understand what the common law, just to say, oh, this is the common law, and these are the rules. No. You have to see the common law as it is contrasted with its great antagonist, the law of the city, the law of the evil empire. And when you see that, then it begins to come clear. I've got in this book a couple of chapters. Maybe when I get through the malicious stuff, if you guys will let me, then I'll try to go through the differences. I just cataloged them. In two or three places, grand, fundamental first principles that are different with the law of the land and the law of the city. You see, the law of the city has a lot of the standards the law of the land has, murders against the law, stealings against the law. But what is different is this, and this is one way to express the grand difference. The law of the land insists upon due process. The law of the city does not. The law of the land has the juries. The law of the city does not. The law of the land follows due process, focuses on it, and doesn't really worry about the result. Just focuses on the process. The law of the city says you must reach the process that the state says, or reach the conclusion, the result, the state says you have to reach. The law of the city is result-oriented. The law of the land is process-oriented. And that's no small thing, because due process is the greatest of all the personal rights our Constitution guarantees. And as a matter of fact, our Constitution is a document of process. It's not a matter of what that the Constitution says. It's a matter of how we're going to do things, how we're going to do them. We follow the process. The Bible says, you follow my process, the process due, and the result is mine. The judgment is mine. You don't have to take the blame for it. You just follow the process, and you'll get the right result. We say at common law, good process, good result. No process or bad process, we're not going to trust the result. We say that from state to state. You drag the records of another court or an extradition hearing from state to state or country to our own country, our courts are bound to look at the process that was followed in that other jurisdiction before they release a prisoner or a person to another state or another country. It's all a matter of process. It ought to be. We need to be talking about it more. But I would say, in answer or response to your question, it's a good question, of course, and people don't know. How can they know? They don't even teach it in the law school. The lawyers don't know. The judges are just following the process out of tradition. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But to really understand and be committed to due process is to be embraced by the common law. That's what it is.
Thank you.
I'm done.
Thank you, Brent.
When I was reading Blackstone's commentaries, it starts out with, if you read his commentaries, you'll understand the common law. It will come to you by reading the commentaries. And
right.
I found that to be enlightening. It was just rambling on and on about all kinds of different stuff, but it was the law of God and nature. And nowhere was there a comparison. Now, is there a Bible specifically written for the law of the land versus the law of the city with text?
Well, if people didn't know better, they'd say that I put you up to this, and I didn't. We have not talked. I don't know you. You're a nice fellow. I'm glad you call in. But you can also purchase my translation of the Bible from the original tongues with footnotes, wherein I go through the Bible, and the whole purpose behind it, it's got over 24,000 footnotes. The whole purpose behind it was to draw those grand distinctions using the Bible, so that people, with things that are familiar to people, a lot of people are familiar with the Bible, but I wanted to translate, because the Bible, of all books, I wanted to put the words in that the Bible is a writing of legal significance from start to finish. Every word goes to legal significance because it's about the will of God. That's what the Bible is. It reveals the person of God by revealing his will, and it does it many ways. It does it in poetry. It does it in history. It does it in biography, like the Gospels. It does it in the epistles in the New Testament. It does it in apocalyptic literature. It does it in all these genres of literature, to reveal to us the will of God, which is the law of God. Remember, law is always somebody's will, what he wants and what he says he's going to get. Well, God has delivered his will to us, and he's done it in the Bible. I was going through the Bible today and had to recheck. I changed some of the words, one of the translated words I go through. I can do things, and God bless all the people who have translated the Bible in the past, but I have something that they didn't have, and I'm using it, and that's a computer. I can go through and translate every Hebrew root word with the same root, English root, and I try to do that as much as possible. They didn't do that, and the reason they didn't do it, because it simply wasn't possible. It was just too massive, and that's what I'm trying to do. And I try to, for example, when it talks about, the Bible talks about judgment, sometimes there's about a dozen words, Hebrew words, translated judgment. The most important one means due process. And I try to translate it every time, due process. And then there's another word that means perjury. It's never translated that way. I don't know why. It could have been for political reasons. The King James Bible, for example, was translated purely for political reasons. I'm glad we have it, but we need to understand the policies behind it. And the Geneva Bible, translated by English-speaking people that were exiled at the city of Geneva in Switzerland. The King James Bible was translated to counter the Geneva Bible, was translated with right ideas. But we need a Bible, in my humble opinion, that shows the undergirding, the mutual reciprocal support of the law of the land and the law of the land, our common law, the laws of nature, revealed in nature, revealed in creation, and the law of God written. The law of God unwritten in creation, the law of God written. And that's what this Bible, you can get this Bible, by the way. I want people to get it. I want to get it out there. It is commonlawyer.com, www.commonlawyer.com. You can order it there. I think it's soon to be coming out on Amazon. I've got another fellow that wants to, he's got connections, and he wants to get it in for a computer format where you can click on, well, you can, on the way I've got it on electronic format now, you can put your cursor on the footnote, and the footnote will come up, but at the same time, it's down below if you want to see it. And in the footnotes, I try to point out the differences as much as I can between the Hebrew word that's used and the English word. Anyway, that you can get it there. The law of God written in the Bible. And as a comparison and contrast, try to show the difference between the law of the land and the law of the city. And the reason I did it, to finish my comment about it, and the reason I still work on it, it's something I'll probably never stop working on, because I can always think of a better way to put it. I see something I didn't see before. But the reason I'm doing it is because I believe in my heart of hearts that if we do not revive the law of God, and it comes in two volumes, the law of God unwritten in creation, our common law, the law of God written in the Bible in particular, if we do not revive those two volumes in America, then the false law of the city in its three primary forms, Roman law, Sharia law, and Talmudic law, will fill that void. Indeed, it's happening now. It's happening fast, and I don't want to be a part of it. Different God, different law. We must promote true law, as Wycliffe did in England. It changed England, and it is responsible. What he did is responsible for the founding of our country, which came a few centuries later.
Sir, I have one more question.
This is going to have to, Fred, this is going to be short because we're running out of time. We've got a lot of people, but short question, short answer. Go ahead.
Let's hope it's short, but I think he's going to expound. What is the benchmark for definitions? I've noticed that in Black's Law dictionaries, definitions of words change by volume.
They do.
What is the benchmark for the definition of a word? Or do you have to reference it to a specific book?
Well, I'm going to make a suggestion to you. Get Blackstone's 7th edition. It's been out for 15 years now or so. But the 7th edition, the editor of that edition was an etymologist. He wasn't a lawyer, but he loved to teach lawyers the meanings of words. And I think he still makes a living doing that, little seminars, and he does legal writing and all sorts of things. But that particular edition goes into a lot of detail about the etymology of words that are used in legal cases. And that's the end of my comment.
Okay, thank you, Brent. Thank you, Fred. Let's move on, Gerard. We've got a few other people here, and it's getting late.
Yep. California, Don, you've been unmuted. Go ahead.
Okay, can you hear me all right?
Yep.
All right, I just wanted to bring up the fact that I've been hearing about this new government we have. It's called a republic. And today, as I was on my computer, I see the G20 summit in China has a very interesting page in here that I'd like to read. It's less than a page. It's from Hangzhou, China. G20 leaders and their benevolent interstellar guides are still in session at this hour. They're unified in final settlement talks for all global disputes while in the same country, same city, same room, and same table. They will not leave this negotiating environment until all matters are deemed collectively resolved and absolute unification is achieved. And when we say all disputes, we mean all disputes worldwide as part of a 30-treaty JSARA package currently being signed and implemented by all your leaders of the newly vibrationally sovereign world. Signatures on all treaties is required by universal law. no country or leader may leave until all treaties are made law via their signature. Former President Barack Obama is not being included in this process as he is no longer deemed the lead diplomat for the Republic of the United States. This is why he did not get the red carpet treatment. General Joseph Dunford is signing all treaties, including the Paris Agreement on climate change, for the Republic of the United States per his own nation's internal constitution. This is precisely why all such real or new leaders have gathered in China, as many are publicly unknown given all the severe and dramatic changes made private in their countries. Many this weekend are meeting for the very first time as to implement GSARA collectively and their combined will through the body of the law will now take full effect beginning in the fourth fiscal quarter of 2016. Extraterrestrial disclosure and human reintegration back into the Galactic Federation of Species will also be implemented and becomes a visible net result of this multi-decade ongoing negotiating process. Global Monetary Reconstitution, a.k.a. the GCR or the RV, is also included within the GSARA legal framework of change. Thus, intake and settlement of all defaulted historic assets, including all fiat currencies, will now be retrieved, redeemed, and revalued, as well as removed from physical existence. The entire global monetary reconstruction process is scheduled to complete by the end of your September, so your world can permanently recalibrate beginning on October 1st. That's all.
You know, I'd like to say something here about a caution, okay? Because I'm hearing some things, and they sound like really good news, but I also see potentially a way of greasing the way or preparing the way for martial law. So we've got to be careful on how we deal with these situations. But, Gerard, did you have a comment on that?
I don't think it ain't going to happen. Okay? It ain't going to happen. It's Benjamin Fulford. Look, there is a monetary change, and the fiat money has run its course, and there's going to be a vacuum, and they're hoping that there's going to be some unrest over that so they can lock us down. That's what I believe. They're talking about extraterrestrials and all this other baloney. I don't believe in that. You know, they have all kinds of technology. They can put holograms in the sky, so they'll have Jesus and they'll have Muhammad and this one and that one, and people will be running around. In the Bible, it says they're going to say he's here. That's what they're going to do. They're going to put up a show on for us, you know. So I would be real careful about what they're saying, because they're planning something big, and we have so much technology today, they might actually pull it off. But you know, we have to keep our feet grounded in the fundamental principles, because they don't change.
Well, we'll know in 6 days, won't we?
Yeah.
I thought it was the 30th. What date are you giving?
Well, and on the 30th, the new money, the that's just a date for the...
Right,
for the,
but I thought he was saying that coming into October also. What date were you giving there?
Oh, he says by the end of September.
Yeah, that's not 6 days.
Well, you guys could check it out on your computer. Just look on hollowearthnetwork.com.
Yeah, we're very familiar with that. And,
okay.
We do have a lot of people who have joined us from that neighborhood. We have people from all kinds of neighborhoods joining us, and we welcome everyone. But, yeah, we've heard some of that, not only from there, but from other sources also. We've had some personal sources that have given us some of this information. But what I'm concerned about is when you take a military leader. What was the name of the – was it a general, you said? What was
Dunford,
the name of that individual?
Dunford.
Yeah, because I have heard Dunford. That numerous times. Didn't we hear that from one of our personal sources too, that name? And I think we also heard other sources with that name coming in. And look at the last thing we need is a general making decisions for, the administration, for the highest office in the land. The last thing we need is the people deciding to go for a military leader to do something to save us. That's the last thing we need.
Well,
the only way America is going to be saved, only one way, and it'll never happen any other way, no matter what anybody thinks, says, or claims. It's irrelevant. It's meaningless. It's not going to happen. Only the people are going to do it. And if people are too lazy, and ultimately it's the will of God that's going to make this happen. We don't need a zillion people to do it. All we need is for the will of God to really require, going to make this happen, and use whatever necessary people around as to do His will, to exercise whatever we can. But the people are the ones that have to step up. Only the people can save America. We have to be careful here.
Okay. Well, from another source, also it was revealed that Paul Ryan will replace Dunsford. And we'll have an election in January. There won't be an election in November. But anyway, I'll leave you with that. You can ponder it.
Yeah.
That's very frightening to hear those kind of things.
Dunford was set up to be the guy if we went into martial law, and that was one of the things that Karen Udies didn't want the money. You know, she didn't want the money to fall. She wanted the gold backing behind the money, so that Dunford wouldn't be able to be, you know, run the common law thing. Now, I don't know that much about Dunford, but when I hear things that he's signing treaties on global climate change, that tells me that he's already bamboozled, because all the scientists have proven that that's a hoax.
A lot of other things in that other than weather.
Look, there's going to be climate change. It's got nothing to do with our factories and our pollution. You can affect an area and this area and that area, but when Mount St. Helens blows up, and Walter Cronkite and Dan Rather sit there and go, Mount St. Helens is blowing more hydrocarbons and sulfur dioxide than all the factories and all the cars and everything since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. What do we think we can do about, you know, look at the cows put out more hydrocarbons than cars. Maybe we should make catalytic converters for cows' backsides. All it's about is control. It's a lie from hell. The earth replenishes itself. God knew what he was doing. All this stuff goes down in the ocean, goes down into the magma, comes up on the other side. Volcanoes make new land. This earth is an organism that has an immune system just like a man does, and it works, and it replenishes itself, and we're not killing the earth, and we are not a virus on the earth. And anybody that plays into that, it's all about control, and it's a fraud. It's just designed to control us more. So,
I'd like to note the one other thing. Well, the same thing. I'm going to almost repeat myself. We better be really, really careful if we the people accept anybody that is a military leader to take over the administrative powers of the United States of America. If that ever happens, I don't care what they claim or how great they are or how good they are. It's the end of America forever if the people accept that. It's done. We will never get it back.
Well, that's my we live in interesting times, trying times and interesting times, and we don't have much further to go to figure out what's going on. Look at this election. This November is a big stepping point here.
Let's hope we're going to know.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Yeah, that's the big thing. Look, I think we'll have a little bit of a sign of relief if we can get to January 20th. I think January 20th is the day of inauguration, is it? That doesn't ever change, no matter what day it falls on. Is that correct?
Right. Is it the 20th, the 10th, or the 20th? I don't know. It's towards the middle of January anyway.
Yeah, well, I know last time it was the 20th. So, but in any event, at least I think it was. In any event, let's get to that day. If we can get to that day and when the election actually survives and it's a real election, which at this point I don't see really happening, but, you know, there's some interesting things happening on the horizon. I think God's fingers in this, and things may happen in such a way that they're not going to be able to get away with fixing this election. And if we're correct in what we're hoping one of the candidates, then getting to January with an election that still holds in America, at least we'll have a little bit of a sigh of relief and at least a little more time. But I fear we may not make that, too. You know, I really don't know. Nobody knows. We don't know what the world's going to look like on October 1st. And we've talked about this September 30th thing. And I've also talked to a friend of mine in the bank who didn't know what I had known in the information. And I had mentioned something about September 30th. He says, oh, you know about October 1st, huh? I think he said October 1st. It might have been October 2nd or 3rd. It was a Monday that was coming up. He said, oh, you know about that. I said, what are you talking about? I know about what? He mentioned that the language in banks are going, I think they called it a black holiday, or what was that phrase that's being used? I think it's a black bank day or a black holiday or something.
A banker's holiday?
Maybe it was black. I thought it was black.
That's what they did in the last depression. They shut the banks for the
week.
Right.
Well,
if they're
going to
close it in
that.
October, that means they're changing the money maybe.
Right. Now, he's a nobody, you know, he's just a teller in a bank, and but he's as much a nobody as we are, too, so let's keep that in mind. And this was his statement to me. It was a totally different thing. He was focusing in on the day after, and I was focusing on the day of, and ultimately he's seeing and hearing something different in the bank. So I don't know what that's all about. All I know is troubling times are coming unless we the people step up, and that's why we push so hard on the committees of safety. People, if you're not involved in these committees of safety and you're not doing something to save your community, you know, your family, your posterity, your neighbors, and us, and yourself, then shame on you. You need to do something. Anybody hearing this, you need to do something. Don't let this go by. Don't think the other guy's doing it. Don't think any of those things. You better do it yourself. That's right.
Okay, well, that's it. Let me pull Kansas. Yeah, we got a couple of minutes left here. I'll give him a chance.
Hi. I just wondered, are us the membership of NLA, are we going to do the letter writing thing type of thing with Mr. Robertson? That troubles me probably as much as anything that I've ever heard, because what could be more innocuous than making cow ponds? You know what I mean? And now they're not happy to just have him in prison, but they've got to murder him as well. And I just feel like, I mean, I don't know if anybody feels the same way I do, but I feel like if we know this and we have an organization that we can work through, and God bless NLA and the common law. John, I've been reading your papers, and they're excellent. But if we don't do something as individuals about this, I just think we're wasting our time. And that's just a comment there. I know there's probably other people waiting. And then the other thing that I just wanted to drop was a piece of information, and I don't even need an answer, but I just wondered if the NLA was aware that there's some kind of reconstitution or attempt to reconstitute the sovereign states, which involves finding two people who have been on homesteaded ground since about the middle of the 1800s. And if they can find two people per state, they can reconstitute the sovereignty of the state. And my final comment would be that the Bundys would be the type of people that they're looking for on our side. They'd be the kind of people that we're looking for, and perhaps that might have something to do with the situation they're in. And I don't really need comments.
Yeah, well, I'd like to comment on some of those things. Just hang in a second. You know, on the first issue, you know, amen to that. We all better get involved and do something. And but, you know, concerning this idea of finding people who are original homesteaders or something that is still in each state too or something, that seems to be a formula drawn up by somebody that has really gone too extreme. It reminds me of the idea of going in using the language of the man on the land, clicking your heels, and presuming that these people all of a sudden are going to back off and say, he figured it out, we got to obey him. You know, I got a bridge in Brooklyn to sell every one of those people, because all they're doing is identifying themselves to begin with, number one. Number two, they're looked at as, they're being laughed at by these people. They've already fix this problem of people coming in and bringing things up, and the judges didn't know how to deal with it. They already fixed that problem. They know how to deal with that very clearly now. And they're just going to find themselves in more troubles, really. And they're not going to get a solution. Look, we know one of the individuals out there in Oregon who has exercised the man on the land language and has done, and in that process has done nothing that's going to be brought up before the jury that's going to give a defense to him, nor any information or any kind of an evidence that shows the fact that these people are political political prisoners and are really being, you know, this whole process is all illegal, everything they're doing and exactly what's going on out there. They're not working on that. And I can tell you that all of the lawyers out there, I feel pretty confident to say this, even though I haven't seen all the exhibits, but I've seen the paperwork. I've read the entire case from beginning to end. I haven't looked at it in the past couple of weeks, but I will be getting back into it to read some more to see what's going on. But I'll tell you what, it doesn't look like any of these lawyers have done anything to get these guys off the hook. They have permitted and allowed the judge to tell these people that they cannot put in an affidavit. They have permitted and they have allowed the judge to tell these people that they cannot tell their story on why they were there. I mean, what is wrong with these lawyers? These lawyers, look at this. I want to be careful with my language. These lawyers are a problem to us. I'm sick and tired of these bar lawyers. I am just sick and tired selling us out and just allowing this to happen. And we're going to, and we're not, we the people are not going to permit this. We at National Liberty Alliance are going to step up. We're going to do something. I don't know about asking people to send any letters or anything of that nature, but clearly at some point in time, we're going to be asking people to make some phone calls. If people want to send a fax or something, that's fine. But I don't think that that is the way to go. I think a phone call, you know, you only need to spend 30 seconds or 15 seconds or 60 seconds on the line, make a 1 or 2 sentence statement and let them know we're watching and we've had enough of this. And then hang up the phone or whatever it is. Be polite and nice and so on and so forth. We're going to lay out a couple of ideas where people might say, people can say whatever they want, but let me tell you, we better come at it with a sense of honor, justice, and mercy. We got to remember, you know, how we deal with this. We have to deal with this godly, because if we're not dealing with it godly, then we're never going to win, because we, the people, can never win this battle against what we're going up against is a machine that is so huge, so well put together, so tightly knit, so powerful, extending to all levels of every government in the United States, and we're talking right down into the towns, extending into almost all, if not all, the nations, in some way every nation, including Russia and China, I don't care where you go, their tentacles go all the way down, and we're up against something that we're up against Leviathan. We're up against a power and an authority that we, the people, collectively, cannot even win against. It is so powerful, so structured, such an oiled machine with all the money of the world at their hands. They control the economy. They control everything. We don't have a chance to win this battle. Only God can win this battle. Only we the people will save America, but only if we are acting with the heart. In the name of honor, in the name of justice, in the name of mercy, only then doing the right thing, just turning the lights on, because our only job is one thing, breaking those vessels with the light underneath so the light will shine and bring darkness out into the light. And
well,
then
I agree.
The rest of the work
and
the God.
Way
the walls
the
of
way,
Jericho will fall, and these people will be totally destroyed by the finger of God. And it's the only way it's going to happen. And I know I get some complaints from people. They're very few, but they do come, and they've come since we began, and the idea of bringing up the Bible. But look, if you don't have this Bible, you don't have God. And that is it. It is the Word of God. And look at Jew, Gentile, even the Muslims. They all agree. They all agree with that conclusion. Okay, so I know there are some people that have a problem with that, but look, we're worthless here if we don't have God. And you know, look, it's not God is on our side, not at all. Either we're on his side or nothing. That's it. We're just doing his will. We're seeing evil. We're seeing wrongdoing. We're in a place. We've come to a place where we can do something about it. We're doing whatever we can. But the battle to be won must be won by the finger of God. And we all have to understand that. And it doesn't take everybody to agree on that. It doesn't matter if everybody agrees on that. But if God's children is awoken and they agree on that, and they are executing and exercising what is necessary, the words of the heart, the law of the heart that God has put in there, and exercising the mind that they have given them to do the right thing, to say the right thing, to turn on those lights, that God will do whatever it is his will is. And I think his will is to protect his children.
Well, I want to say one more thing, is I agree with you, but it's going to take some Davids to stand up. Little David, go stand up in front of Goliath, and that is us. That's the NLA. And I just want to know what it is that we're going to do as a collective
but, you know, we'll do it as individuals, but under the head of NLA, what are us little Davids out here together going to do under the authority and headship, I don't mean authority, but under the headship and leadership of the NLA for Mr. Robbins,
well,
or Mr. Robinson?
Let me say
something about Mr. Robbins. First of all, they could give anything less about his bonds. This has nothing to do with his bonds. All these cases go much deeper than that. If they want the land. In the Bundy case and in the Malheur case, they promised the uranium rights to China and Russia, and they collected money on it, and they have to deliver it. That's what it's about. It goes right up to the White House. So you're not just fighting for Joe. They want to get rid of Joe because they want his land, because they've already promised it to these foreign governments. And that's what's going on. So when you say, we got to do something for Joe, they won't let Joe go because they've already sold his land years ago, because they had them prop up our debt, and they said, this is collateral. And so they gave his land away when he didn't even know it. So it's not just a matter of them letting Joe go. What you're doing is you're fighting that corporate oligarchy right to the top. That's why this job is hard. It's not just because Joe. Look, they should let Joe go. It's all baloney. We know it's baloney. Just like we're going to affect the earth because we light a match. Joe didn't pollute a river 200 or 110 miles from his house. That's all a lie. It's all smoke and mirrors. And it's going to go away when we click our heels finally and say, look, these guys have nothing. They have no clothes. And we got to stop listening to them. And we have to stop self-policing for them. And that's what's going on. That's how we're going to win this battle, when everybody wakes up and says enough is enough, you know. And so, you know, it could start with Joe, maybe, I don't know. But right now, those tentacles go much deeper than Joe digging a pond, believe me.
Yeah, I do understand.
Jen, hold on one second. Let me just make a correction of perception. I know we're going to let you talk, even if we go a little late tonight. Let me make a correction of perception, and this is extremely important. National Liberty Alliance is a facilitator. Okay, for everything that we're doing. Everything we're doing is really being done by what we have constructed and took years to put together, was a unified United States common law grand jury. So we got to keep coming to that, because that's where the real power is, and that's where the real authority is, and that's how we go into the courts, in the name of the unified United States common law grand jury, the sureties of peace, standing up for we the people. We are the king's bench. And we're going to go in and we're going to make some corrections here. We're going to do some things that haven't been done in many years and is out there in the common law and even in the statutory system. We're going to do some things, and I'm not sure how they're going to respond to this, but it doesn't matter. It's still, again, building up, again, the pressure upon the walls of Jericho. Because those walls, one way or the other, are going to come down. There's no doubt in my mind or heart that I know and I can see that that's going to happen. But at some point, the pressure is just going to break open, and we the people, by God's will, if we're in his will and under his, in the sense of doing his will, and truly coming in with the right attitude, not with vengeance and anger and hatred, but with love and concern and honor and justice. That's how we have to come in. And whatever it takes, you know. But, you know, again, it is the grand jury that has to do the job. And when we do it, it's coming up very soon. There are certain papers getting ready to go into the courts. And when they go into the courts, we're going to be putting the word out. We're hoping that everybody really gets involved to make the noise. Okay? We have to get our horns up and blow those horns around Jericho and bring those walls of resistance down. We need the people with the boots on the grounds that are out there in these three states. And we're looking particularly big focus is really on Oregon, but it may very well be Montana. Even though we don't have the boots on the ground in Montana, it may be the Montana case that really breaks this thing open. But there's also the Nevada case. So there's three cases involved here, and all three of them are connected. All three of them are connected. It's the same problem, the same people. It's the BLM. It's the federal agencies, and they're destructive. They've got criminals. They purposely have put criminals in the place of our law enforcement on these levels. And these people don't care about anything but really they're filled with their own ego. I think a lot of them are sadists because of the things that they do. I mean, who goes around kicking people or hitting someone in the head with an odd object, a weapon or whatever, and doing the things they do, going into people in prison that are chained up and beating them up or not feeding them for days or allowing them to be in their own waste for days on end. And I mean, who does that? But sadists. I mean, I just don't get it. I mean, these people, they don't care about anything. Where do they get these people from? Well, they have to go out of their way to find them and give them these federal jobs. I mean, just think about it. You know, I know people who years ago were called to work for the Fed. And let me tell you, they came and investigated these people. They learned everything. They knocked on doors, family, friends, relatives, stores. I mean, they just scoured the neighborhood. Okay, and they talked to everyone that they could find that had any contact with this person before taking them in to become working for the federal government on the levels that we're talking about. What happened to all that? Where did that go to? They know who these people are. They know that they're evil. They know that they'll do dirty deeds. They know this. And these are the people that we're up against. But anyway, look at when the call goes out, I certainly hope that people get up and do the right thing and step up and make the call. And again, it's only going to take a minute or two or 30 seconds and just get the message in. They need to hear from around the country. This is coming from everywhere, and we're sick and tired of it. And you need to back up this paperwork. We've got to do it. But anyway, back to you.
Okay. And I've been on every phone call for 7 months except two. And I still haven't joined NLA because I've talked to you about that, about the sin of money and that kind of thing. I've read your papers, and I love the heart of NLA, and I love your heart and Gerard's and Jan's and everybody, Veronica, everybody that, you know, is really involved. But what is the thing is that we've got people that we know about, individual people that we know about, and John, maybe I've got the wrong organization. Maybe I just need to take the education that I've gotten from NLA and move on to somewhere else. But if you don't allow the NLA, for what you guys have constructed, you should have 500,000 members. And if you do not let the people get involved and instruct us and lead us as individuals to let our heart go to turn the reins loose under your supervision. We're under your supervision for a reason, or I'm not using the right word, but we're staying under the umbrella of NLA because we love what NLA is. But if you do not give us a job besides going to talk to a sheriff who's already done an oath to the cabal, and we've already gathered up our beans and our water and our light bulbs for if something happens, and if you do not let our hearts turn loose like yours is, you're going to keep losing people because, I mean, there are things that we can be doing right now, and really, we want you for our leader, you and Gerard, or we wouldn't be here.
Well, I can tell you that we do not suffer from attrition. I mean, of course, we do get some. Every organization does get some, but we don't have an attrition problem. We do grow. We're not growing as fast as we'd like to grow on the one hand, but on the other hand, maybe growing too quick is not so good either. I think I've been very thankful when we were hitting the 1,000 mark or trying to even hit the 500 mark and we want to go quicker. I'm thankful we didn't grow quicker back then because we wasn't ready. We didn't know how to handle certain things and certain problems. Infiltration has tried many, many ways. And in this, let me tell you, in this organization, if we want to call it an organization or a collection of the people, we the people assembling together to do the right thing and take this nation back and bring it back to a republic again under the people, you know, working at that. We have been assaulted on numerous ways from numerous places, inside states and even up on the top end up here. And we have survived every one of them. And we've been able to recognize the enemy very early on by God's will. And it's not hard because look at, you know, just listen to people talk and it doesn't take long to figure out that they're a problem. Or you get people who you know of just mimicking you. And so you're careful and watch and lo and behold, the things happen. You know, you can see they really don't understand, but they're saying all the right things, but they really don't understand. So, you know, we see those things and those things by God's mercies we've been able to do something about. We've kept a very tight hold on paperwork. We can't just let other people just get together, for instance, a particular state grand jury, unified grand jury in a particular state to go in and start writing papers, unless they're really, really educated, they need to understand and know what needs to be said. And it has to really be done with really a spear point. And that's why we developed the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury. And there were very few people involved in the paper writing. Although anybody can get involved once they get to, as they move into the system and volunteer, and they may find themselves in areas where they get involved. And if anybody does get to a point where they deliver good information that could be used and start to see it, we do have some people who really do see it. Fine, but it takes a while because it's really a mindset. Our education has been nothing but to put us into slavery, and we have to break out of this thing. We have to be free thinkers. But where the real power is, and the authority's got to be back on the grassroots. We've always understood that. That's always been our focus, and very early on we came up with the motto, or whatever you want to call it. As time goes on, NLA must decrease and the people must increase. But the people need to become educated. They need to become structured. And we try doing the best we can to do that. On the administrative process side, we're putting together a book. Look, it's real simple. The law is written in the hearts. Let's rest in that. Let's believe that. Let's act in faith on that. We will. So the law is written in the heart. So these four administrators, if they take the vow and they hold each other to the extent of those vows, the three make sure that the other one is doing the right thing, acting in honor. When they're not, let them know they're not. And they either got to repent and get back into the fold, or they got to leave. And we have a whole process set up for that. But we are creating a book. And that book is really a handbook to assist people. We've put two courses together to give people a good kind of baseline of understanding and knowledge of what it is. And people will, the cream of the crop will show up at the right time. It'll come to the top. But first,
see, this is my point, John. That's just my point.
Yeah, I would never
talk you down, except for the fact that I'm just making my point, is that whenever somebody tries to bring something up, that you do that to them. You talk them down. You go over you steamroll over the idea. And it's okay, because you have to be the leader. I understand that. But you are just absolutely squelching the growth that's just trying to pop out all over NLA. And after 7 months of listening to every single call, I'm very, very aware of that, and I'm also aware that if I try to grow in NLA, that you're not going to let me do it. And
well,
so,
I'm
going to make a final comment and quit. I'll quit, and you can talk for the rest of the time. But I'm going to take NLA for what it has delivered to me, and that's an awful lot. But, John, you're really holding back people, and that's my final comment.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. I suggest to you to get a hold of Jan. We have a national leadership. Speak with them. Deliver your points to them. I listen very carefully to what they say. It's a rare case where I go against the whole. It may have happened on one or two occasions, but you bring it up to them and show them what it is that you think. Believe me, there are things that you don't realize, and I bang my head against the wall to some degree talking. There's national leaders that will tell you this, if you go talk to them, trying to really free people as much as I can. But if they don't have the right mindset, and you let people go, and believe me, we've let people go to do things, and they cause destruction. It gets lost in ego sometimes, but not just ego. The big thing is lack of understanding of the truth and holding on to the points that need to be held on. It's really very simple. If you're going to go into the courts, it's very simple. It's always to the same thing, jurisdiction and due process. It's always the same thing. Yet a lot of people, I'll talk to people about cases and courts and different things and ideas, and they just can't get it. And it's a hard concept to get. And I can give you some thoughts and ideas on maybe that might be. I don't know whether I'd be on point on that. But look, let me just get back to what I was trying to complete. What we have tried to do is to free the people in the other places we can, in the political realms, and also on the boots on the ground by committing, getting the committees of safety. We have absolute zero control on every committee of safety we create. We rest in God and that the membership of National Liberty Alliance that have been with us for a while and understand and agree with the principles and the concepts that we've put together, understand that we have to be within the will of God and do the best thing we can. We're resting on those people to control what goes on the grounds, because believe me, we've had people, I haven't seen it lately, thankfully, but we've had a lot of people who want violence, who have come into the National Liberty, we want to do this, we got to do that. They're full of hatred. They want to come in with vengeance. They want to do things or say things that just is not the right way to go. It's not the way to go with these things. So what I'm challenging you to do is to define, because this is the second or third time we've had this similar kind of a conversation. It's still not clear on me where it is that I'm restrictive, but take this to the national leadership. Show them what it is that you're trying to say. Get them to understand what you're saying, and then they'll pull me into the conversation, and then we'll discuss it, and we'll see where we're at or even if we're already addressing it.
Look,
so we're addressing
I want to make a comment here, John.
Yes.
One of the things that we've understood, and you have to be careful what you ask for. You got to be ready. Now, we've always said the day we get into the courts, that's when everybody's going to be turned loose, because once we're in the courts, then people are going to start operating on the local level. And that's going to happen. And it may happen in these cases here, it looks like. But once we get in the courts and they accept us, you're going to be running. You better have your four administrators ready. You better be ready. Now, we had one state in particular thought they were going to get in another way through some other process, and we let them go. And they completely got lost. They went through some other paper writing doing this man on the land stuff, and we lost the whole state.
And they ended up in jail with one of the guys.
They ended up in jail.
That didn't have to be there.
Look, you say free people. So many times we wanted to do things, and we got stymied, and we said, it must be God's will. You know, a lot of times we let go of the rope, and we said, oh, that's terrible. We should have been here. We should have been there. And then one day we walk over and pick the rope up, and we figured out, and we find out that they wrapped it around their necks, and we were in a better position in the second time. So it's not our timing. It's God's timing. And yes, I know everybody is fed up and sick, and we're all impatient to go out there and run. You say free people. Well, you know, when you have an army, you have generals, and you have a whole chain of command, and you have a plan. If you just free people, you have to do it. They have to be – look, liberty requires maturity and responsibility. Do you think that we have 5,000 people that are ready to do this? I hope we do. I think they're closer now than they ever were. Look, we've put a massive amount of stuff, and we've promised to stay here as long as they need us. Once we get in the courts, you won't keep up. You're going to be free to do whatever you want to do, and you're going to have so much to do in every place. I don't know how we're going to handle it, to tell you the truth, because there's so much stuff to clean up. You know what I mean?
Principle will handle it. Principle.
That's right.
Honor, justice,
right.
And mercy is what's going to control.
Go.
We
right.
The people going to control the
right.
Courts. And as long as we're holding each other accountable, those three are holding the fourth person accountable at all times, then we will be in the right place at the right time all the time. And look, at National Liberty Alliance will be here constantly for being able to guide people, to counsel people, to give them information, to find information, to help them with writing papers, give them the booklets and the information. We're already working on the plans of a video for orientation, okay, for the juries, the grand jury and the trial juries. We've read through, we've evaluated, we've studied the handbooks that they've got. We've seen the evil that they put into these handbooks. We've seen their questionnaires. We know we've seen all that stuff. We now can take that kind of an idea, kind of use some of that stuff in the sense of the ideas of what they put together to do what they did to actually enslave the jury. We're going to turn it around and free the jury, free the people. Look, at the jury doesn't need to be a lawyer. All they need to be is really to get in touch with their heart and get in touch with their mind from the standpoint of what is logical and what is right and wrong, which really comes from the heart. and stand on principles, because those four administrators got to deliver the same point to those 12 or those 25, honor, justice, and mercy. They got their 8 hours to deal with these people, to orientate them, to bring them to that point, to understand that the 24 must hold the 25th accountable. If one is acting outside of justice, outside of honor, outside of mercy, they need to be chastised by the 24. Or if it's the 12 inside the courtroom, then the 11 got to get on the 12th. You see, they need the same principle, and it's very simple to teach people these things. And people do know they're going into a court. They kind of put themselves in the place. Well, what if I was there? I'd want a good jury. You know, people who are going to do the right thing. So that kind of heart is there. They know that the job they're going to be doing is serious. Okay. So now, if you really free them and give them the right tools, and you don't need much, again, we just need the people, the regular people. As Jefferson said it very clearly, you can only trust it in the people. You can't trust it anyplace else. But if the people don't know, teach them, educate them, let them know. Okay? That's what National Liberty Alliance is doing, or trying to do, is to teach, to educate, to let them know. We don't have it all, and we're not perfect, and we don't have it all right, but we do our best, and when we do discover an error, we fix it. But as far as controlling people, I don't think we really do at all. I think we give a lot of freedom to a lot of things, and we're trying to guide people and control them to the point when they go outside the fold. And we try to make it clear to those people who really want to go a different direction. You can do that, and I hope you're successful, but don't drag the whole bunch. Don't come to us to rob our membership, to take them with you and do something, you know, that's going to put them in jail. They're counting on our counseling and to keep out of jail. National Liberty Alliance has done everything to do the things in such a way that they can't put us in jail, or they can't, at least not now, they can't come out after us yet. But as far as getting on to the political realms and on the streets, the committees of safety, you know, people are free to do whatever they want. We're trying to really get that. That's what's going to hopefully build our membership, if we can really get that motivating and going. But I'm not sure I understand what it is you think that I can do, or I should be doing, or where I'm going wrong, or how I got to let loose. Bring it to the national leadership. Believe me, if they agree with you, they're going to come down on me. That's their job. That's why they're there, and that's why we put them there. Anyway,
you know, look at Brent gave a couple of really good nuggets tonight, and he said there's two kinds of laws, and one of them is outcome-based, and the other one is process-based. Now, the other side, if we could only work half as hard as the enemy that has done this to us, we would be successful. What do we have in school today? We have outcome-based education. They have taught people to think the way that they need them to think to make their system survive and go further. They give us outcome. That's what we're up against. If all of our members and all the and the average public out there has to learn the process, they have to learn how to think, and they have to learn due process. Once you get that in your heart, then you can go ahead and you can go out there and you can do something. And that's what we're up against. We need that critical mass where we have thinking people in every state, and enough in each county, because counties can help each other. I don't know what that number is. I don't know what that magic number is. Only God knows. But we have to get that process, that due process, in people's hearts and in their minds so that they know how to function once they get out there. You know, you can give a book, an instruction book, and all this, but, you know, until you actually live it in your heart, like Brent says, you keep reading it and you keep pulling more stuff out of it, you know. I've taken Constitution courses, many different ones, and I'm going to tell you, the one that Bagnarik gives is not real technical, but when you get done with it, you have the idea of this nation and the Constitution in your heart. You start to develop the discernment between right and wrong and true liberty with that particular course. His course is like that. So that's where we're at. People have to understand these processes before they can put them in place. And all if we're holding anybody back, it's only because they're not doing the process or something. But we've had lots of ideas that have come in, and maybe you haven't heard of them because we set people loose in different places, and we do it like a beta thing. We'll try something in an area and we'll see what happens. You know what I mean? And if it doesn't flush out, then we go back to the drawing board. There's lots of that stuff. Like John says, you go to the national leadership and say, I have an idea to do this or that. And we've tried ideas like that. And that's partially why we keep moving ahead. And there's a lot of other organizations out there that are also slashing and cutting. I think this system is suffering the death of a thousand cuts because we're not the only ones out there. Look, if we were the only ones, we would be targeted. You know, they would really turn up. But they got a lot of problems in a lot of different places because people are waking up. And it's in no small part due to our education and the other educations that are out there that they're suffering now. And I take a lot of consolation in that, I guess. I can see it, I can feel it, I can taste it. Look, we're so close now. You know, the one thing that's going to get us is if we're impatient. You know, I said, don't fire till you see the white of their eyes, because there's some truth to that. You have to be ready. So, look, I want to go forward. I want to get in the courts. I want to clean things up, you know, as much as anybody else does. But we have to do it in a way that we're doing the process, that we're not discrediting ourselves, or we don't go off on a tangent and get lost with those things that men always get lost in, with pride, money, and power. We have to be careful of these things. So I think I've said enough, but that's where we're at. And if anybody has any kind of idea for moving forward that looks like it could do something, we're always willing to listen and try to and even do a test on it and see how it works. So
right.
We,
okay. Well,
Jen,
maybe when I mail in my check for my radio, I'll get my thoughts together and put it down on paper and mail that in too, so that's pulled together. But that was probably
You got to bring it up to Jen directly or to Ron or one of the national leaders.
Get a little bit
of a conversation with them and get a meeting. They'll get together to some of the other leaders. They'll come together and they'll listen to you. Throw it back and forth. Jen's listening right now, so I know he'll do it. And I'm not sure exactly what it is that you're suggesting or where it is they're holding, but show it to them. Believe me, they will come to me with this because they're as interested in making this work as you and I am also. And they can find once you go through them and they boil it down, if there's a flaw here in me or Gerard or whatever it is we're doing, believe me, they'll bring it to our attention and we'll fix it.
I just want to say that what I said sounded maybe like a argument or a criticism, but it's a compliment. It's a compliment because I see a bigger vision for what NLA. You guys are wonderful leaders. I mean, you are your heart. I mean, the whole thing. I won't go into it because it's so late. But it was a compliment. I mean, I understand.
But apparently, though, there is something that you think I should know, and I'm just not getting it. Make them understand it. They'll make me
I just don't think you think. I don't think you see the leader that you are, that I see, and that others of us see. I think you're thinking smaller, and that goes for you too, Gerard and Jan and Carl. I just don't think that you guys see yourselves as the leaders that the people following you see.
Well, maybe
see
that's
you
a
as.
Good thing because you're right. I don't think about those things, but maybe it is.
People are looking for leaders. You can go and gather people, or you can talk at a grocery store. You can get people around you if you just proclaim the truth. They listen. So the people, you're right. The people are ripe for leaders. Now, some of the things that distract us are those things that we need to take care of. You know, we're holding the water in the dike back. Number one was the Committee of Safeties and Communications, because if they have their way and they can put us under martial law and our communication goes down, look, if we can't communicate across this nation, we're done. We're dead. You know what I mean? We have to be able to communicate. So we kind of had to put that up front right away because it looks like it's very around the corner here. It's imminent. So by putting in, by hooking up with the ham radios, getting people knowledgeable about how to communicate and all that, that's the thing that will stop it from happening. It's like when they sent that battleship, the USS Kennedy, out there. It was a ship that was due to be decommissioned, and they sent it into the Middle East. And I think it was Alex Jones, and I always had the jury out on Alex Jones, and he started screaming, What are you sending that ship out there with a skeleton crew? You're going to sink it. You're going to make a false flag. You're going to start World War III with that ship. You know what they did? They turned around and took it home, and it never happened. And I believe that they were going to do a false flag. And that's the effect that we can have by educating, getting people so they can communicate. Once you get, look, there, those guys are out there already. There's ham radio operators in every state. If we can hook in with them and give them a plan and a structure for disaster preparedness, and believe me, the other side is trying to educate them also on disaster preparedness, telling them when and how to hand off their authority and what to put out there. So we have a battle here with the communications, but if we don't at least meet it and push back, we're done. So these things became very important, and we kind of neglected some of the paperwork stuff that we were going to do out west and certain things that we were planning on doing because necessity said you got to go over here. Look, if you're running something and you do triage like a hospital, and now all of a sudden you got an artery that's squirting blood. You got to leave that stitches you're doing, and you got to go put pressure on it. And we do a lot of damage control, and so sometimes it may look like we're holding back and stuff, but we see something that comes to the forefront that we have to deal with. And this whole committee of safety thing was very important. Look, it's something our forefathers had to do because it's kind of like outside of the government. It's the people assembling with no control of a town board or any political entity.
The body politic in action.
Right. So that's what a lot of it is. But you know, look, we can discuss this further, but I'm just trying to say that certain things are, you know, that we're doing, we're trying to do a triage to get to a point. And there's this whole other thing marching down. And so there's a lot of psyops too on the other side. You know, they're always whispering in our ears, trying to unsettle us. So it's very hard to keep your feet on the ground and figure out what direction you're going, you know.
We're 27 minutes over. I never let it go that far. We're 27 minutes over, but I do want to give David just 30 seconds and maybe a 30-second response. We can't spend much time for whatever
he's
it is.
Probably
but,
ready to burst.
But we can. I know. But you know, get to us early on next week, and we'll try to pull you up to the front. But if you want to make a point, David, real quick, go right ahead. You got the mic for 30 seconds, and then we got to shut down.
Yeah, I was trying to get you some more information on diesel therapy. And there's an article on here where they had a guy by the name of George Hansen. He had 12 terms in the as a congressman, and he landed up having to go through these. And it's a good thing to look up on Google. It's called if you go to diesel therapy by what legal statute? Diesel therapy by what legal statute? And the first one up there. Apparently, there's a newspaper or somebody by the name of Winds, W-I-N-D-S, and it talks about George Hansen, diesel therapy, and Susan McDougall.
Okay, I'm typing it into my Google right now. I'll see if I can't get that and find it. I was looking, as we were talking earlier, I was looking to get cut and paste and information because we're going to deal with this issue, and I do want to get anything that really is a story that really makes the point that's credible.
Well, this guy was fighting this thing as he was living it, so to speak. I think he did land up dying in prison, and when he was going through this, it makes the point that he was 63 years old. So if anybody, and one of the good points is he happened to be a congressman in Idaho. So it's in the bailiwick where you're talking about.
Okay, I got diesel therapy by what legal authority? Is that what it is?
No, by what legal statute, S-T-A-T-U-T-E.
Okay, so that's what I'm hitting right now. Okay, I got him, George Hansen. Okay, we got it. Okay, I'll look into that.
Okay, God bless. I hope it helps you.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Okay, with that, we're going to thank you. We're going to end it for the evening. I appreciate everyone coming. I appreciate those who have stayed late to listen in and participate. And look, we don't have much time. Let's do whatever we got to do. And hopefully by doing what we have to do now, maybe it'll give us more time. But we got a lot of work to do. Let's go do it. come to us on Thursday and work with us to organize the nation and give. We need money. We're desperate for money. We really are. I hate to do that, but I have to. What am I going to do? If we don't have money, we can't keep the lights on, so to speak. So, okay, thanks, everyone. God bless. We'll see you next Monday. Thank you.